Insomnia by Stephen King. Read by Eli Wallach. Prologue. Winding a death watch. Old age is an island surrounded by death. Juan Montalvo on beauty. No one, least of all Dr. Litchfield, came right out and told Ralph Roberts that his wife was going to die. But there came a time when Ralph understood without needing to be told. The months between March and June were a jangling, screaming time inside his head. A time of conferences with doctors, of evening runs to the hospital with Carolyn, of trips to other hospitals in other states for special tests. Ralph spent much of his travel time on these trips thanking God for Carolyn's Blue Cross major medical coverage, of personal research in the Derry Public Library, at first looking for answers the specialists might have overlooked, later on just looking for hope and grasping at straws. Those 4 months were like being dragged drunk through some malign carnival, where the people on the rides were really screaming, the people lost in the mirror maze were really lost, and the denizens of Freak Alley looked at you with false smiles on their lips and terror in their eyes. Ralph began to see these things by the middle of May, and as June set in, he began to understand that the pitchmen along the medical midway had only quack remedies to sell, and the cheery, quick step of the calliope could no longer quite hide the fact that the tune spilling out of the loudspeakers was the funeral march. It was a carnival, all right, a carnival of lost souls. Ralph continued to deny these terrible images and the even more terrible idea lurking behind them all through the early summer of 1992. But as June gave way to July, this finally became impossible. The worst midsummer heat wave since 1971 rolled over central Maine, and Derry simmered in a bath of hazy sun, humidity, and daily temperatures in the mid-90s. The city, hardly a bustling metropolis at the best of times, fell into a complete stupor, and it was in this hot silence that Ralph Roberts first heard the ticking of the death watch, and understood that in the passage from June's cool, deep greens to the baked stillness of July, Carolyn's slim chances had become no chances at all. She was going to die. Not this summer, probably. The doctors claimed to have quite a few tricks up their sleeves yet, and Ralph was sure they did. But this fall, or this winter, his longtime companion, the only woman he had ever loved, was going to die. He tried to deny the idea, scolding himself for being a morbid old fool. But in the gasping silences of those long hot days, Ralph heard that ticking everywhere. It even seemed to be in the walls. Yet it was loudest from within Carolyn herself, and when she turned her calm, white face toward him, perhaps to ask him to turn on the radio so she could listen while she shelled some beans for their supper, or to ask him if he would go across to the Red Apple and get her an ice cream on a stick, he would see that she heard it too. He would see it in her dark eyes, at first only when she was straight, but later, even when her eyes were hazed by the pain medication she took. By then, the ticking had grown very loud, and when Ralph lay in bed beside her on those hot summer nights, when even a single sheet seemed to weigh 10 pounds, and he believed every dog in Derry was barking at the moon, he listened to it, to the death watch ticking inside Carolyn, and it seemed to him that his heart would break with sorrow and terror. How much would she be required to suffer before the end came? How much would he be required to suffer? And how could he possibly live without her? It was during this strange, fraught period that Ralph began to go for increasingly long walks through the hot summer afternoons and slow, twilight evenings, returning on many occasions too exhausted to eat. He kept expecting Carolyn to scold him for these outings, to say, "Why don't you stop it, you stupid old man? You'll kill yourself if you keep walking in this heat." But she never did. And he gradually realized she didn't even know. That he went out, yes, she knew that. But not all the miles he went, or that when he came home he was often trembling with exhaustion and near sunstroke. Once upon a time it had seemed to Ralph she saw everything, even a change of half an inch in where he parted his hair. No more. The tumor in her brain had stolen her powers of observation, as it would soon steal her life. So he walked, relishing the heat in spite of the way it sometimes made his head swim and his ears ring, relishing it mostly because of the way it made his ears ring. Sometimes there were whole hours when they rang so loudly and his head pounded so fiercely that he couldn't hear the tick of Carolyn's death watch. He walked over much of Derry that hot July, a narrow-shouldered old man with thinning white hair and big hands that still looked capable of hard work. He walked from Witcham Street to the Barrens, from Kansas Street to Nybold Street, from Main Street to the Kissing Bridge, but his feet took him most frequently west along Harris Avenue, where the still beautiful and much-beloved Carolyn Roberts was now spending her last year in a haze of headaches and morphine, to the Harris Avenue Extension and Derry County Airport. He would walk out the extension, which was treeless and completely exposed to the pitiless sun, until he felt his legs threatening to cave in beneath him, and then double back. He often paused to catch his second wind in a shady picnic area close to the airport service entrance. At night, this place was a teenage drinking and make-out spot, alive with the sounds of rap coming from boombox radios. But during the days, it was the more or less exclusive domain of a group Ralph's friend Bill McGovern called the Harris Avenue Old Crocs. The Old Crocs gathered to play chess, to play gin, or just to shoot the shit. Ralph had known many of them for years, had in fact gone to grammar school with Stan Eberle, and was comfortable with them, as long as they didn't get too nosy. Most didn't. They were old-school Yankees, for the most part, raised to believe that what a man doesn't choose to talk about is no one's business but his own. It was on one of these walks that he first became aware something had gone very wrong with Ed Deepnow, his neighbor from up the street. Ralph had walked much further out the Harris Avenue extension than usual that day, possibly because thunderheads had blotted out the sun and a cool, if still sporadic, breeze had begun to blow. He had fallen into a kind of trance, not thinking of anything, not watching anything but the dusty toes of his Converse sneakers, when the 445 United Airlines flight from Boston swooped low overhead, startling him back to where he was with the teeth-rattling whine of its jet engines. He watched it cross above the old GS and WM railroad tracks and the cyclone fence that marked the edge of the airport, watched it settle toward the runway, mark the blue puffs of smoke as its wheels touched down. Then he glanced at his watch, saw how late it was getting, and looked up with wide eyes at the orange roof of the Howard Johnson's just up the road. He had been in a trance, all right. He'd walked over 5 miles without the slightest sense of time passing. Carolyn's time, a voice deep inside his head muttered. Yes, yes, Carolyn's time. She would be back in the apartment, counting the minutes until she could have another Darvon complex. And he was out on the far side of the airport, halfway to Newport, in fact. Ralph looked up at the sky and for the first time really saw the bruised purple thunderheads which were stacking up over the airport. They did not mean rain, not for sure, not yet. But if it did rain, he was almost surely going to be caught in it. There was nowhere to shelter between here and the little picnic area back by Runway 3, and there was nothing there but a ratty little gazebo that always smelled faintly of beer. He took another look at the orange roof, then reached into his right-hand pocket and felt the little sheaf of bills held by the silver money clip Carolyn had given him for his 65th. There was nothing to prevent him walking up to Hojo's and calling a cab, except maybe for the thought of how the driver might look at him. Stupid old man, the eyes in the rearview mirror might say. Stupid old man, walked a lot farther than you should on a hot day. If it had been swimming, it would have drowned. Paranoid Ralph, the voice in his head told him, and now its clucky, slightly patronizing tone reminded him of Bill McGovern. Well, maybe it was, and maybe it wasn't. Either way, he thought, he would chance the rain and walk back. What if it doesn't just rain? Last summer it hailed so hard that one time in August it broke windows all over the west side. Let it hail, then, he said. I don't bruise that easy. Ralph began to walk slowly back toward town along the shoulder of the extension, his old high tops raising small parched puffs of dust as he went. He could hear the first rumbles of thunder in the west, where the clouds were stacking up. The sun, although blotted out, was refusing to quit without a fight. It edged the thunderheads with bands of brilliant gold and shone through occasional rifts in the clouds, like the fragmented beam of some huge movie projector. Ralph found himself feeling glad he had decided to walk, in spite of the ache in his legs and the steady, nagging pain in the small of his back. One thing at least, he thought. I'll sleep tonight. I'll sleep like a damn rock. The verge of the airport, acres of dead brown grass with a rusty railroad track sunk in them like the remains of some old wreck, was now on his left. Far in the distance, beyond the cyclone fence, he could see the United 747, now the size of a child's toy plane, taxiing toward the small terminal which United and Delta shared. Ralph's gaze was caught by another vehicle, this one a car, leaving the general aviation terminal, which stood at this end of the airport. It was heading across the tarmac, toward the small service entrance which gave on the Harris Avenue extension. Ralph had watched a lot of vehicles come and go through that entrance just lately. It was only 70 yards or so from the picnic area where the Harris Avenue old Crocs gathered. As the car approached the gate, Ralph recognized it as Ed and Helen Deepnose Rust Bucket Datsun. And it was really moving. Ralph stopped on the shoulder, unaware that his hands had curled into anxious fists, as the small brown car bore down on the closed gate. You needed a key card to open the gate from the outside. From the inside, an electric I-beam did the job. But the beam was set close to the gate, very close, and at the speed the Datsun was going. At the last moment, or so it seemed to Ralph, the small brown car scrunched to a stop, the tires sending up puffs of blue smoke that made Ralph think of the 747 touching down, and the gate began to trundle slowly open on its track. Ralph's fisted hands relaxed. An arm emerged from the driver's side window of the Datsun and began to wave up and down, apparently haranguing the gate, urging it to hurry it up. There was something so absurd about this that Ralph began to smile. The smile died before it had exposed even a gleam of teeth, however. The wind was still freshening from the west, where the thunderheads were, and it carried the screaming voice of the Datsun's driver.
You son of a bitch fucker! You bastard! Eat my cock! Hurry up and lick shit! You fucking asshole cunt-lapper fucking booger! Rat dick ring meat suckhole!
That can't be Ed Deepno, Ralph murmured. He began to walk again without realizing it. Can't be. Ed was a research chemist at the Hawking Laboratories research facility in Fresh Harbor, one of the kindest, most civil young men Ralph had ever met. Both he and Carolyn were very fond of Ed's wife, Helen, and their new baby, Natalie, as well. A visit from Natalie was one of the few things with the power to lift Carolyn out of her own life these days. And sensing this, Helen brought her over frequently. Ed never complained. There were men he knew who wouldn't have cared to have the missus running to the old folks down the street every time the baby did some new and entrancing thing, especially when the granny figure in the picture was clearly ill. Ralph had an idea that Ed wouldn't be able to tell someone to go to hell without suffering a sleepless night in consequence. But...
You fucking whoremaster! Move your sour shit-caked ass, you hear me? Buttfucker cunt-rammer!
But it sure sounded like Ed. Even from 200 or 300 yards away, which he now was, it certainly sounded like him. Now the driver of the Datsun was revving his engine like a kid in a muscle car waiting for the light to turn green. Clouds of exhaust smoke farted up from the tailpipe. As soon as the gate had retracted enough to allow the Datsun passage, it leaped forward, squirting through the gap with its engine roaring. And when it did, Ralph got a clear look at the driver. He was close enough now for there to be no doubt. It was Ed, all right. The Datsun bounced along the short, unpaved stretch of lane between the gate and the Harris Street extension. A horn blared suddenly, and Ralph saw a blue Ford Ranger, heading west on the extension, swerve to avoid the oncoming Datsun. The driver of the pickup saw the danger too late, and Ed apparently never saw it at all. It was only later that Ralph came to consider Ed might have rammed the Ranger on purpose. There was a brief scream of tires, followed by the hollow bang of the Datsun's fender driving into the Ford sidewall. The pickup was driven halfway across the yellow line. The Datsun's hood crumpled, came unlatched, and popped up a little. Headlight glass tinkled into the street. A moment later, both vehicles were dead in the middle of the road, tangled together like some weird sculpture. Ralph stood where he was for the time being, watching as oil spread beneath the Datsun's front end. He had seen several road accidents in his almost 70 years, most of them minor, one or two serious, and he was always stunned by how quickly they happened and how little drama there was. It wasn't like in the movies, where the camera could slow things down, or on a videotape where you could watch the car go off the cliff again and again if you so chose. There was usually just a series of converging blurs, followed by that quick and toneless combination of sounds, the cry of the tires, the hollow bang of metal, crimping metal, the tinkle of glass. Then, voila, tout fini. There was even a kind of protocol for this sort of thing, how one should behave when involved in a low-speed collision. Of course there was, Ralph mused. There were probably a dozen two-bit collisions in Derry every day, and maybe twice that number in the wintertime when there was snow and the roads got slippery. You got out, you met your opposite number at the point where the two vehicles had come together, and where quite often they were still entwined. You looked, you shook your heads. Sometimes, often actually, this phase of the encounter was marked with angry words. Fault was assigned, often rashly, driving skills impugned, legal action threatened. Ralph supposed what the drivers were really trying to say without coming right out and saying it was, "Listen, fool, you scared the hell out of me." The final step in this unhappy little dance was the exchange of the sacred insurance screeds, and it was at this point that the drivers usually began to get control of their galloping emotions, always assuming that no one had been hurt, as appeared to be the case here. Sometimes the drivers involved even finished up by shaking hands. Ralph prepared to watch all this from his vantage point less than 150 yards away, but as soon as the driver's door of the Datsun opened, he understood that things were going to go differently here, that the accident was maybe not over, but still happening. It certainly did not seem that anyone was going to shake at the end of these festivities. The door did not swing open, it flew open. Ed Deepno leaped out, then simply stood stock still beside his car, his slim shoulders squared against the background of deepening clouds. He was wearing faded jeans and a T-shirt, and Ralph realized he'd never seen Ed in a shirt that didn't button up the front before today. And there was something around his neck, a long white something. A scarf? It looked like a scarf, but why would anyone be wearing a scarf on a day as hot as this one had been? Ed stood beside his wounded car for a moment, seeming to look in every direction but the right one. The fierce little pokes of his narrow head reminded Ralph of the way roosters studied their barnyard turf, looking for invaders and interlopers. Something about that similarity made Ralph feel uneasy. He'd never seen Ed look that way before, and he supposed that was part of it, but it wasn't all of it. The truth of the matter was simply this. He'd never seen anyone look exactly like that. Thunder rumbled in the west, louder now and closer. The man getting out of the Ranger would have made two of Ed Deepno, possibly three. His vast, deep belly hung over the rolled waistband of his green chino work pants. There were sweat stains the size of dinner plates under the arms of his open-throated white shirt. He tipped back the bill of the West Side Gardener's gimme cap he was wearing to get a better look at the man who had broadsided him. His heavy jowled face was dead pale, except for bright patches of color like rouge high on his cheekbones. And Ralph thought, there's a man who's a prime candidate for a heart attack. If I was closer, I bet I'd be able to see the creases in his earlobes. "Hey!" the heavy-set guy yelled at Ed. The voice coming out of that broad chest and deep gut was absurdly thin, almost reedy. "Where did you get your license? Fucking Sears and Roebuck?" Ed's wandering, jabbing head swung immediately toward the sound of the big man's voice, seemed almost to home in like a jet guided by radar, and Ralph got his first good look at Ed's eyes. He felt a bolt of alarm light up in his chest and suddenly began to run toward the accident. Ed, meanwhile, had started toward the man in the sweat-soaked white shirt and gimme cap. He was walking in a stiff-legged, high-shouldered strut that was nothing at all like his usual easy-going amble. "Ed!" Ralph shouted, but the freshening breeze, cold now with the promise of rain, seemed to snatch the words away before they could even get out of his mouth. Certainly Ed never turned. Ralph made himself run faster, the ache in his legs and the throbbing in the small of his back forgotten. It was murder he had seen in Ed Deepnose's wide, unblinking eyes. He had absolutely no previous experience on which to base such an assessment, but he didn't think he could mistake such a naked glare. It was the look fighting cocks must wear when they launch themselves at each other, spurs up and slashing. "Ed! Hey, Ed! Hold up! It's Ralph!" Not so much as a glance around, although Ralph was now so close that Ed must have heard, wind or no wind. Certainly the heavy-set man glanced around, and Ralph could see both fear and uncertainty in his look. Then heavy-set turned back to Ed and raised his hands placatingly. "Look," he said, "we can talk." That was as far as he got. Ed took another quick step forward, reached up with one slim hand, it was very white in the rapidly darkening day, and slapped heavy-set across his far from inconsiderable jowls. The sound was like the report of a kid's air rifle. "How many have you killed?" Ed asked. Heavyset pressed back against the side of his pickup, his mouth open, his eyes wide. Ed's queer, stiff strut never faltered. He walked into the other man and stood belly to belly with him, seemingly oblivious of the fact that the pickup's driver was 4 inches taller and outweighed him by 100 pounds or more. Ed reached up and slapped him again. "Come on! Fess up, brave boy! How many have you killed?" His voice rose to a shriek that was lost in the coming storm's first really authoritative clap of thunder. Heavyset pushed him away, a gesture not of aggression, but of simple fright, and Ed went reeling backward against the crumpled nose of his Datsun. He bounced back at once, fists clenched, clearly gathering himself to leap at Heavyset, who was cringing against the side of his truck, with his gimme cap now askew and his shirt untucked in the back and at the sides. A memory flashed across Ralph's mind. A Three Stooges short he'd seen years ago. Larry, Curly, and Moe playing painters without a clue. And he felt a sudden surge of sympathy for Heavyset, who looked absurd as well as scared to death. Ed Deepnose did not look absurd. With his yanked back lips and wide, unblinking eyes, Ed looked more like a fighting cock than ever. "I know what you've been doing," he whispered to Heavyset. "What kind of comedy did you think this was? Did you think you and your butcher friends could get away with it for a..." At that moment, Ralph arrived, puffing and gasping like an old cart horse, and put an arm around Ed's shoulders. The heat beneath the thin T-shirt was unnerving. It was like putting an arm around a blast furnace. And when Ed turned to look at him, Ralph had the momentary but unforgettable impression that that was exactly what he was looking into. He'd never seen such utter, unreasoning fury in a pair of human eyes, had never even suspected such fury might exist. Ralph's immediate impulse was to recoil, but he suppressed it and stood firm. He had an idea that if he pulled back, Ed would fall on him like a rogue dog, biting and clawing. It was absurd, of course. Ed was a research chemist. Ed was a member of the Book of the Month Club, the kind who took the 20-pound histories of the Crimean War they always seemed to offer as alternates to the main selection. Ed was Helen's husband and Natalie's dad. Hell, Ed was a friend. Except this wasn't that Ed, and Ralph knew it. Instead of pulling back, Ralph leaned forward, grasped Ed's shoulders, so hot under the T-shirt, so incredibly, throbbingly hot, and moved his face until it blocked Heavyset from Ed's creepy fixed gaze. "Ed, quit it," Ralph said. He used the loud but steadily firm voice he assumed one used with people who were having hysterics. "You're all right. Just quit it." For a moment, Ed's fixed gaze didn't waver, and then his eyes moved over Ralph's face. It wasn't much, but Ralph felt a small surge of relief just the same.
"What's the matter with him?"
Heavyset asked from behind Ralph.
"He crazy, do you think?"
"He's fine, I'm sure," Ralph said, although he was sure of no such thing. He spoke out of the corner of his mouth, like an actor in a bad prison movie, and didn't take his eyes from Ed. He didn't dare take his eyes from Ed. That contact felt like the only hold he had over the man, and tenuous at best.
"Just shaken up from the crash. He needs a few seconds to calm down." "Ask him what he's got under that top!"
Ed yelled suddenly, and pointed over Ralph's shoulder. Thunder whacked again, as if on cue. Lightning flashed, and for a moment the pitted scars of Ed's adolescent acne were thrown into sharp relief, like some strange organic treasure map.
"Hey, hey, Susan Day!"
he chanted in a high, childlike voice that made Ralph's forearms break out in goosebumps.
"How many kids did you kill today?" "He ain't shook up," Heavyset said. "He's crazy. And when the cops get here, I'm going to see he gets taken in."
Ralph glanced around and saw a blue tarpaulin stretched across the bed of the pickup. It had been tied down with bright yellow hanks of rope. Round shapes bulked beneath it.
"Ralph?"
a timid voice asked. He glanced to his left and saw Dorrance Marsteller, at 90-something, easily the oldest of the Harris Avenue old crocs, standing just beyond Heavyset's pickup truck. There was a paperback book in his waxy, liver-spotted hands, and Dorrance was bending it anxiously back and forth, giving the spine a real workout. Ralph supposed it was a book of poetry, which was all he'd ever seen old Dorrance read. Or maybe he didn't really read at all. Maybe he just liked to hold the books and look at the artfully stacked words.
"Ralph, what's wrong? What's happening?"
Lightning flashed overhead, a purple-white snarl of electricity. Dorrance looked up at it as if unsure of where he was, who he was, or what he was seeing. Ralph groaned inside.
"Dorrance," he began,
and then Ed lunged beneath him like some wild animal which has only lain quiet to regain its strength. Ralph staggered, then pushed Ed back against the crumpled hood of his Datsun. He felt panicky, unsure of what to do next or how to do it. There were too many things going on at once. He could feel the muscles in Ed's arms humming fiercely just below his grip. It was almost as if the man had somehow swallowed a bolt of the lightning now loose in the sky.
"Ralph?"
Dorrance asked in that same calm but worried voice.
"I wouldn't touch him anymore if I were you. I can't see your hands."
"Oh, good. Another lunatic to deal with. Just what he needed."
Ralph glanced down at his hands, then looked at the old man.
"What are you talking about, Dorrance?"
"Your hands," Dorrance said patiently.
"I can't see your..."
"This is no place for you, Dor. Why don't you get lost?"
The old man brightened a little at that.
"Yes,"
he said in the tone of one who had just stumbled over a great truth.
"That's just what I ought to do."
He began to back up, and when the thunder cracked again, he cringed and put his book on top of his head. Ralph was able to read the bright red letters of the title. Buck Dance's Choice.
"It's what you ought to do, too, Ralph. You don't want to mess in with long-time business. It's a good way to get hurt."
"What are you..."
But before Ralph could finish, Dorrance turned his back and went lumbering off in the direction of the picnic area with his fringe of white hair, as gossamer as the hair on a new baby's head, rippling in the breeze of the oncoming storm. One problem was solved, but Ralph's relief was short-lived. Ed had been temporarily distracted by Dorrance, but now he was looking daggers at Heavyset again.
"Cunt liquor!"
he spat.
"Fucked your mother and licked a cunt!"
Heavyset's enormous brow drew down.
"What?"
Ed's eyes shifted back to Ralph, whom he now seemed to recognize.
"Ask him what's under that top," he cried. "Better yet, get the murdering cocksucker to show you."
Ralph looked at the heavyset man.
"What have you got under there?"
"What's it to you?" Heavyset asked, perhaps trying to sound truculent.
He sampled a look in Ed Deepnose's eyes and took two more sidling steps away.
"Nothing to me. Something to him," Ralph said, lifting his chin in Ed's direction. "Just help me cool him out, okay?"
"You know him?"
"Murderer!"
Ed repeated, and this time he lunged hard enough under Ralph's hands to drive him back a step. Yet something was happening, wasn't it? Ralph thought the scary, vacant look was seeping out of Ed's eyes. There seemed to be a little more Ed in there than there had been before. Or perhaps that was only wishful thinking.
Murderer! Baby murderer! Jesus, what a Looney Tune, Heavyset said.
But he went to the rear of the truck bed, yanked one of the ropes free, and peeled back a corner of the tarpaulin. Beneath it were four pressboard barrels, each marked Weed Go.
Organic fertilizer, Heavyset said, his eyes flicking from Ed to Ralph, and then back to Ed again.
He touched the bill of his West Side gardener's cap.
I spent the day working on a set of new flower beds outside the dairy psych wing, where you could stand a short vacation, friend.
Fertilizer? Ed asked. It was himself he seemed to be speaking to. His left hand rose slowly to his temple and began to rub there.
Fertilizer?
He sounded like a man questioning some simple yet staggering scientific development.
Fertilizer, Heavyset agreed. He glanced back at Ralph and said, this guy is sick in the head, you know it?
He's confused, that's all, Ralph answered uneasily. He leaned over the side of the truck and wrapped a barrel top. Then he turned back to Ed.
Barrels of fertilizer, he said. Okay?
No response. Ed's right hand rose and began to rub at his other temple. He looked like a man sinking into a terrible migraine.
Okay? Ralph repeated gently.
Ed closed his eyes for a moment, and when they opened again, Ralph observed a sheen in them he thought was probably tears. Ed's tongue slipped out and dabbed delicately first at one corner of his mouth and then the other. He took the end of his silk scarf and wiped his forehead, and as he did, Ralph saw there were several Chinese figures embroidered on it in red, just above the fringe.
I guess maybe,
he began and then broke off. His eyes widened again in that look Ralph didn't like.
Babies, he rasped. You hear me? Babies!
Ralph shoved him back against his car for the third or fourth time. He'd lost count.
What are you talking about, Ed?
An idea suddenly occurred to him. Is it Natalie? Are you worried about Natalie? A small, crafty smile touched Ed's lips. He looked past Ralph at the heavy-set man.
Fertilizer, huh? Well, if that's all it is, you won't mind opening one of them, will you?
Heavyset looked at Ralph uneasily.
Man needs a doctor, he said.
Maybe he does. But he was calming down, I thought.
Could you open one of those barrels? It might make him feel better. Yeah, sure. What the heck? In for a penny, in for a pound.
There was another flash of lightning, another heavy blast of thunder, one that seemed to go rolling all the way across the sky this time, and a cold spackle of rain struck the back of Ralph's sweaty neck. He glanced to his left and saw Dorrance Marsteller standing at the entrance to the picnic area, book in hand, watching the three of them anxiously.
It's going to rain a pretty bitch, looks like, Heavyset said, and I can't let this stuff get wet. It starts a chemical reaction, so look fast.
He felt around between one of the barrels and the side wall of his truck for a moment, then came up with a crowbar.
I must be as nutty as he is doing this, he said to Ralph. I mean, I was just going along home, minding my business. He hit me.
Go on, Ralph said. It'll only take a second.
Yeah,
Heavyset replied sourly, turning and setting the flat end of the crowbar under the lid of the nearest barrel.
But the memories will last a lifetime.
Another thunderclap rocked the day just then, and Heavyset did not hear what Ed Deepno said next. Ralph did, however, and it chilled the pit of his stomach.
Those barrels are full of dead babies, Ed said. You'll see.
Heavyset popped the lid on the end barrel, and such was the conviction in Ed's voice that Ralph almost expected to see tangles of arms and legs and bundles of small hairless heads. Instead, he saw a mixture of fine blue crystals and brown stuff. The smell which rose from the barrel was rich and peaty, with a thin chemical undertone.
See? Satisfied?
Heavyset asked, speaking directly to Ed again.
I ain't Ray Joubert or that guy Dahmer, after all. How about that?
The look of confusion was back on Ed's face, and when the thunder cracked overhead again, he cringed a little. He leaned over, reached a hand toward the barrel, then looked a question at Heavyset. The big man nodded to him, almost sympathetically, Ralph thought.
Sure, touch it.
fine by me. But if it rains while you're holding a fistful, you'll dance like John Travolta. It burns. Ed reached into the barrel, grabbed some of the mix, and let it run through his fingers. He shot Ralph a perplexed look. There was an element of embarrassment in that look as well, Ralph thought, and then sank his arm into the barrel all the way to the elbow. "Hey," Heavyset cried, startled, "that ain't a box of Cracker Jack." For a moment, the crafty grin resurfaced on Ed's face, a look that said, "I know a trick worth two of that." And then it subsided into puzzlement again as he found nothing further down but more fertilizer. When he drew his arm out of the barrel, it was dusty and aromatic with the mix. Another cannonade of thunder exploded above the airport. The lightning which followed gave the faces of Ed and Heavyset the momentary look of overexposed photographs. "Get that off your skin before it rains, I'm warning you," Heavyset said. He reached through the Ranger's open passenger window and produced a McDonald's takeout sack. He rummaged in it, came out with a couple of napkins, and handed them to Ed, who began to wipe the fertilizer dust from his forearm like a man in a dream. While he did this, Heavyset replaced the lid on the barrel, tamping it into place with one large freckled fist, and taking quick glances up at the darkening sky. When Ed touched the shoulder of his white shirt, the man stiffened and pulled away, looking at Ed warily. "I think I owe you an apology," Ed said. And to Ralph his voice sounded completely clear and sane for the first time. "You're damn tootin'," Heavyset said. But he sounded relieved. He stretched the plastic-coated tarpaulin back into place and tied it in a series of quick, efficient gestures. Watching him, Ralph was struck by what a sly thief time was. Once he could have tied that same sheet bend with that same dexterous ease. Today he could still tie it, but it would take him at least 2 minutes and maybe three of his best curse words. Heavyset patted the top and then turned to them, folding his arms across the substantial expanse of his chest. "Did you see the accident?" he asked Ralph. "No," Ralph said at once. He had no idea why he was lying, but the decision to do it was instantaneous. "I was watching the plane land, the United." To his complete surprise, the flushed patches on Heavyset's cheeks began to spread. "You were watching it too," Ralph thought suddenly. "And not just watching it land, either, or you wouldn't be blushing like that. You were watching it taxi." This thought was followed by a complete revelation. Heavyset thought the accident had been his fault, or that the cop or cops who showed up to investigate might read it that way. He'd been watching the plane and hadn't seen Ed's reckless charge through the service gate and out to the extension. "Look, I'm really sorry," Ed was saying earnestly. But he actually looked more than sorry. He looked dismayed. Ralph suddenly found himself wondering how much he trusted that expression, and if he really had even the slightest idea of, "Hey, hey, Susan Day," what had just happened here. And who the hell was Susan Day, anyhow? "I bumped my head on the steering wheel," Ed was saying, "and I guess it, you know, it rattled my cage pretty good." "Yeah, I guess it did," Heavyset said. He scratched his head, looked up at the dark and convoluted sky, then looked back at Ed again. "Want to make you a deal, friend." "Oh? What deal is that?" "Let's just exchange names and phone numbers instead of going through all that insurance shit. Then you go your way and I go mine." Ed looked uncertainly at Ralph, who shrugged, and then back at the man in the West Side gardener's cap. "If we get into it with the cops," Heavyset went on, "I'm in for a ration of shit. First thing they're going to find out when they call it in is I had an OUI last winter, and I'm driving on a provisional license. They're apt to make problems for me even though I was on the main drag and had the right of way. See what I mean?" "Yes," Ed said. "I guess so. But the accident was entirely my fault. I was going much too fast." "The accident part is maybe not so important," Heavyset said, then looked mistrustfully around at an approaching panel truck that was pulling over onto the shoulder. He looked back at Ed again and spoke with some urgency. "You lost some oil, but it stopped leaking now. I bet you could drive a home if you live here in town." "You live here in town?" "Yes," Ed said. "And I'd stand you good on repairs. Up to $50 or so." Another revelation struck Ralph. It was the only thing he could think of to explain the man's sudden change from truculence to something close to Wheedling. An OUI last winter? Yes, probably. But Ralph had never heard of such a thing as a provisional license, and thought it was almost certainly bullshit. Old Mr. Westside Gardeners had been driving without a license. What complicated the situation was this. Ed was telling the truth. The accident had been entirely his fault. If we just drive away and call it good, Heavyset was going on, I don't have to explain all over again about my OUI, and you don't have to explain why you jumped out of your car and started slapping me and yelling about how I had a truckload of dead bodies. Did I actually say that? Ed asked, sounding bewildered. You know you did, Heavyset told him grimly. A voice with a wispy French-Canadian accent asked, Everything okay here, fellas? Nobody hurt, eh? Ralph, that you? The truck which had pulled over had Derry Dry Cleaners printed on the side, and Ralph recognized the driver as one of the Vachon brothers from Old Cape. Probably Trigger, the youngest. That's me, Ralph said, and without knowing or asking himself why, he was operating purely on instinct at this point, he went to Trigger, put an arm around his shoulders. It was his day for that, it seemed, and led him back in the direction of the laundry truck. Them guys okay? Fine, fine, Ralph said. He glanced back and saw that Ed and Heavyset were standing by the truck bed with their heads together. Another cold spatter of rain fell, drumming on the blue tarpaulin like impatient fingers. A little fender bender, that's all. They're working it out. Beauty, beauty, Trigger Vachon said complacently. How that pretty little wife of yours, Ralph. Ralph twitched, suddenly feeling like a man who remembers at lunch that he's forgotten to turn off the stove before leaving for work. Jesus, he said, and looked at his watch, hoping for 5:15, 5:30 at the latest. Instead, he saw it was 6:10. Already 20 minutes past the time Carolyn expected him to bring her a bowl of soup and half a sandwich. She would be worried. In fact, with the lightning and the thunder booming through the empty apartment, she might be downright scared. And if it did rain, she would not be able to close the windows. She had almost no strength left in her hands. Ralph, Trigger asked, what's wrong? Nothing, he said. It's just that I got walking and lost all track of time. Then this accident happened, and... Could you give me a ride home, Trig? I'll pay you.
No need to pay nothing, Trigger said. It's on my way up in, Ralph. You think those guys gonna be all right? Ain't gonna take after each other or nothing?
No, Ralph said. I don't think so. Just one second.
Sure.
Ralph walked over to Ed. Are you okay with this? Are you getting it worked out?
Yes, Ed replied. We're going to settle it privately.
Why not? A little broken glass is all it really comes down to. He sounded completely like his old self now, and the big man in the white shirt was looking at him with something that was almost respect. Ralph still felt perplexed and uneasy about what had happened here, but he decided he was going to let it go. He liked Ed Deepnow a lot, but Ed was not his business this July. Carolyn was. Carolyn, and the thing which had started ticking in the walls of their bedroom, and inside her, late at night.
Great, he told Ed. I'm headed home. I make Carolyn her supper these days, and I'm running way late.
He started to turn away. The heavy-set man stopped him with an outstretched hand.
John Tandy, he said.
He shook it. Ralph Roberts, pleased to meet you. Tandy smiled.
Under the circumstances, I kind of doubt that. But I'm real glad you showed up when you did. For a few seconds there, I really thought him and me was going to tango.
So did I, Ralph thought, but didn't say. He looked at Ed, his troubled eye taking in the unfamiliar T-shirt clinging to Ed's stalk-thin midriff and the white silk scarf with the Chinese red figures embroidered on it. He didn't entirely like the look in Ed's eyes when they met his. Ed was perhaps not all the way back after all.
Sure you're okay? Ralph asked him.
He wanted to go, wanted to get back to Carolyn, and yet he was somehow reluctant. The feeling that this situation was about 9 miles from right persisted.
Yes, fine, Ed said quickly, and gave him a big smile which did not reach his dark blue eyes.
They studied Ralph carefully, as if asking how much he had seen, and how much, hey, hey, Susan Day, he would remember later on. The interior of Trigger Vashon's truck smelled of clean, freshly pressed clothes, an aroma which for some reason always reminded Ralph of fresh bread. There was no passenger seat, so he stood with one hand wrapped around the door handle and the other gripping the edge of a Dandux laundry basket. "Man, that looked like some strange Goan back there," Trigger said, glancing into his outside mirror. "You don't know the half of it," Ralph replied. "I know the guy driving the rice burner, Deepno his name is. He got a pretty little wife, sent stuff out sometime. Seemed like a nice fella, most usually." "He sure wasn't himself today," Ralph said. "I had a bug up his ass, did he?" "He had a whole damn ant farm up there, I think." Trigger laughed hard at that, pounding the worn black plastic of the big steering wheel. "Whole damn ant farm! Beauty, beauty! I'm saving that one, me." Trigger wiped his streaming eyes with a handkerchief almost the size of a tablecloth. "Look to me like Mr. Deepno come out that airport service gate, him." "That's right, he did." "You need a pass to use that way," Trigger said. "How Mr. D get a pass, you think?" Ralph thought it over, frowning, then shook his head. "I don't know. It never even occurred to me. I'll have to ask him next time I see him." "You do that," Trigger said, "and ask him how them ants doing." This stimulated a fresh throw of laughter, which in turn occasioned more flourishes of the comic opera handkerchief. As they turned off the extension and onto Harris Avenue proper, the storm finally broke. There was no hail, but the rain came in an extravagant summer flood, so heavy at first that Trigger had to slow the panel truck to a crawl.
"Wow," he said respectfully, "this remind me of the big storm back in 85, when half of downtown fell in a damn canal. Remember that, Ralph?"
"Yes," Ralph said. "Let's hope it doesn't happen again."
"Nah," Trigger said, grinning and peering past his extravagantly flapping windshield wipers. "They got the drainage system all fixed up now. Beauty."
A combination of the cold rain and the warm cab caused the bottom half of the windshield to steam up. Without thinking, Ralph reached out a finger and drew a figure in the steam.
"What's that?" Trigger asked.
"I don't know, really. Looks Chinese, doesn't it? It was on the scarf Ed Deepno was wearing."
"Look a little familiar to me," Trigger said, glancing at it again. Then he snorted and flapped a hand. "Listen to me, would you? Only thing I can say in Chinese is Mu Gu Gai Pan."
Ralph smiled, but didn't seem to have a laugh in him. It was Carolyn. Now that he'd remembered her, he couldn't stop thinking about her, couldn't stop imagining the windows open and the curtains streaming like Edward Gorey ghost arms as the rain poured in.
"You still live in that two-story across from the Red Apple?"
"Yes." Trigger pulled into the curb, the wheels of the truck spraying up big fans of water. The rain was still pouring down in sheets. Thunder cracked and lightning raced it across the sky.
"You better stay right here with me for a little bit," Trigger said. "She'll let up in a minute or two."
"I'll be all right." Ralph didn't think anything could keep him in the truck a second longer, not even handcuffs. Concern had become gnawing intuition.
"Thanks, Trig." "Wait a sec. Let me give you a piece of plastic. You can put it over your head like a rain hat."
"No, that's okay. No problem. Thanks. I'll just..." There seemed to be no way of finishing whatever it was he was trying to say. And now what he felt was close to panic. He shoved the truck's passenger door back on its track and jumped out, landing ankle-deep in the cold water racing down the gutter. He gave Trigger a final wave without looking back, then hurried up the walk to the house he and Carolyn shared with Bill McGovern, feeling in his pocket for his latchkey as he went. When he reached the porch steps, he saw he wouldn't need it. The door was standing ajar. Bill, who lived downstairs, often forgot to lock it. And Ralph would rather think it had been him than think that Carolyn had wandered out to look for him and been caught in the storm. That was a possibility Ralph did not even want to consider. He hurried into the shadowy foyer, wincing as thunder banged deafeningly overhead, and crossed to the foot of the stairs. He paused there a moment, hand on the newel post of the banister, listening to rainwater drip from his soaked pants and shirt onto the hardwood floor. Then he started up, wanting to run, but no longer able to find the next gear up from a fast walk. His heart was beating hard and fast in his chest. His soaked sneakers were clammy canvas anchors dragging at his feet. And for some reason, he kept seeing the way Ed Deepno's head had moved,
when he got out of his Datsun. Those stiff, quick jabs that made him look like a rooster spoiling for a fight. The third riser creaked loudly, as it always did, and the sound provoked hurried footsteps from above. They were no relief because they weren't Carolyn's. He knew that at once. And when Bill McGovern leaned over the rail, his face pale and worried beneath his trademark Panama hat, Ralph wasn't really surprised. All the way back from the extension, he had felt that something was wrong, hadn't he? Yes, but under the circumstances, that hardly qualified as precognition. When things reached a certain degree of wrongness, he was discovering, they could no longer be redeemed or turned around. They just kept going wronger and wronger. He supposed that on some level or other, he'd always known that. What he had never suspected was how long that wrong road could be. Ralph, Bill called down, thank God, Carolyn's having... Well, I guess it's some sort of seizure. I just dialed 911, asked him to send an ambulance. Ralph discovered he could run up the rest of the stairs after all. She was lying half in and half out of the kitchen, with her hair in her face. Ralph thought there was something particularly horrible about that. It looked sloppy. And if there was one thing Carolyn refused to be, it was sloppy. He knelt beside her and brushed the hair away from her eyes and forehead. The skin beneath his fingers felt as chilly as his feet inside his soaked sneakers. I wanted to put her on the couch, but she's too heavy for me, Bill said nervously. He'd taken off his Panama and was fiddling nervously with the band. My back, you know? I know, Bill. It's okay, Ralph said. He slid his arms under Carolyn and picked her up. She did not feel heavy to him at all, but light, almost as light as a milkweed pod, which is ready to burst open and disgorge its filaments into the wind. Thank God you were here. I almost wasn't, Bill replied, following Ralph into the living room and still fiddling with his hat. He made Ralph think of old Dorrance Marsteller with his book of poems. I wouldn't touch him any more if I were you, old Dorrance had said. I can't see your hands. I was on my way out when I heard a hell of a thud. It must have been her falling. Bill looked around the storm-darkened living room, his face somehow distraught and avid at the same time, his eyes seeming to search for something that wasn't there. Then they brightened. The door, he said. I'll bet it's still open. It'll be raining in. I'll be right back, Ralph. He hurried out. Ralph barely noticed. The day had taken on the surreal aspects of a nightmare. The ticking was the worst. He could hear it in the walls, so loud now that even the thunder could not blot it out. He put Carolyn on the couch and knelt beside her. Her respiration was fast and shallow, and her breath was terrible. Ralph did not turn away from it, however. Hang in there, sweetheart, he said. He picked up one of her hands, it was almost as clammy as her brow had been, and kissed it gently. You just hang in there. It's fine. Everything's fine. But it wasn't fine. The ticking sound meant that nothing was fine. It wasn't in the walls either. It had never been in the walls, but only in his wife, in Carolyn. It was in his dear one. She was slipping away from him. And what would he ever do without her? You just hang on, he said. Hang on, you hear me? He kissed her hand again and held it against his cheek. And when he heard the wobble of the approaching ambulance, he began to cry. She came around in the ambulance as it sped across Derry. The sun was already out again, the wet streets steaming. And at first she talked such gibberish that Ralph was sure she had suffered a stroke. Then, just as she began to clear up and speak coherently, a second convulsion struck, and it took both Ralph and one of the paramedics who had answered the call to hold her down. It wasn't Dr. Litchfield who came to see Ralph in the third floor waiting room early that evening, but Dr. Jamal, the neurologist. Jamal talked to him in a low, soothing voice, telling him that Carolyn was now stabilized, that they were going to keep her overnight, just to be safe, but that she would be able to go home in the morning. There were going to be some new medications, drugs that were expensive, yes, but also quite wonderful. We must not be losing the hope, Mr. Roberts, Dr. Jamal said. No, Ralph said, I suppose not. Will there be more of these, Dr. Jamal? Dr. Jamal smiled. He spoke in a quiet voice that was rendered somehow even more comforting by his soft Indian accent. And although Dr. Jamal did not come right out and tell him that Carolyn was going to die, he came as close as anyone ever did during that long year in which she battled to stay alive. The new medications, Jamal said, would probably prevent any further seizures, but things have reached a stage where all predictions had to be taken with the grains of salt. The tumor was spreading in spite of everything they had tried, unfortunately. The motor control problems may show up next, Dr. Jamal said in his comforting voice, and I am seeing some deterioration in the eyesight, I'm afraid. Can I spend the night with her? Ralph asked quietly. She'll sleep better if I do. He paused and added, so will I. Of course, Dr. Jamal said, brightening. That is a fine idea. Yes, Ralph said heavily. I think so, too. So he sat beside his sleeping wife, and he listened to the ticking that was not in the walls, and he thought, someday soon, maybe this fall, maybe this winter, I will be back in this room with her. It had the feel not of speculation, but of prophecy, and he leaned over and put his head on the white sheet that covered his wife's breast. He didn't want to cry again, but did a little anyway. That ticking, so loud and so steady. I'd like to get hold of what's making that sound, he thought. I'd stamp it until it was so many pieces scattered across the floor. With God as my witness, I would. He fell asleep in his chair a little after midnight, and when he woke the next morning, the air was cooler than it had been in weeks, and Carolyn was wide awake, coherent and bright-eyed. She seemed, in fact, hardly to be sick at all. Ralph took her home and began the not inconsiderable job of making her last months as comfortable as possible. It was a long while before he thought of Ed Deepnow again, even after he began to see the bruises on Helen Deepnow's face. It was a long time before he thought of Ed again. As that summer became fall, and as that fall darkened down toward Carolyn's final winter, Ralph's thoughts were occupied more and more by the death watch, which seemed to tick louder and louder even as it slowed down. But he had no trouble sleeping. That came later. Part 1. Little Bald Doctors. There is a gulf fixed between those who can sleep and those who cannot. It is one of the great divisions of the human race. Iris Murdoch, Nuns and Soldiers. About a month after the death of his wife, Ralph Roberts began to suffer from insomnia for the first time in his life. The problem was mild to begin with, but it grew steadily worse. 6 months after the first interruptions in his heretofore unremarkable sleep cycle, Ralph had reached a state of misery he could hardly credit, let alone accept. Toward the end of the summer of 1993, he began to wonder what it would be like to spend his remaining years on Earth in a starry-eyed daze of wakefulness. Of course, it wouldn't come to that, he told himself. It never does. But was that true? He didn't really know. That was the devil of it. And the books on the subject Mike Hanlon steered him to down at the Derry Public Library weren't much help. There were several on sleep disorders, but they seemed to contradict one another. Some called insomnia a symptom, others called it a disease, and at least one called it a myth. The problem went further than that, however. So far as Ralph could tell from the books, no one seemed exactly sure what sleep itself was, how it worked, or what it did. He knew he should quit playing amateur researcher and go to the doctor, but he found that surprisingly hard to do. He supposed he still bore Dr. Litchfield a grudge. It was Litchfield, after all, who had originally diagnosed Carolyn's brain tumor as tension headaches, except Ralph had an idea that Litchfield, a lifelong bachelor, might actually have believed that Carolyn was suffering from nothing but a moderate case of the vapors. And Litchfield, who had made himself as scarce as medically possible once Carolyn was diagnosed. Ralph was positive that if he had asked the man about that point blank, Litchfield would have said he had handed the case off to Jamal, the specialist. All quite proper and above board. Yes, except Ralph had made it his business to get a good look into Litchfield's eyes on the few occasions he had seen him between Carolyn's first convulsions last July and her death this March. And Ralph thought that what he'd seen in those eyes was a mixture of unease and guilt. It was the look of a man trying very hard to forget he is fucked up. Ralph believed the only reason he could still look at Litchfield without wanting to knock his block off was because Dr. Jamal had told him that an earlier diagnosis probably would have made no difference. By the time Carolyn's headache started, the tumor was already well entrenched, and no doubt sending out little bursts of bad cells to other areas of the brain like malignant care packages. In late April, Dr. Jamal had left to establish a practice in southern Connecticut, and Ralph missed him. He thought that he could have talked about his sleeplessness to Dr. Jamal, and he had an idea that Jamal would have listened in a way Litchfield wouldn't, or couldn't. By late summer, Ralph had read enough about insomnia to know that the type with which he was afflicted, while not rare, was a lot less common than the usual slow sleep insomnia. People unaffected by insomnia are usually in first stage sleep 7 to 20 minutes after turning in. Slow sleepers, on the other hand, sometimes take as long as 3 hours to slip below the surface. And while normal sleepers begin to ramp down into third stage sleep, what some of the old books called theta sleep, Ralph had discovered, 45 minutes or so after drifting off, slow sleepers usually took an additional hour or two to get down there, and on many nights they did not get all the way down at all. They awoke unrefreshed, sometimes with unfocused memories of unpleasant, tangled dreams, more often with the mistaken impression that they had been awake all night. Following Carolyn's death, Ralph began to suffer from premature waking. He continued to go to bed most nights following the conclusion of the 11 o'clock news, and he continued to pop off to sleep almost at once. But instead of waking promptly at 6:55, 5 minutes before the clock radio alarm buzzed, he began to wake at 6. At first, he dismissed this as no more than the price of living with a slightly enlarged prostate and a 70-year-old set of kidneys. But he never seemed to have to go that badly when he woke up, and he found it impossible to get back to sleep, even after he'd emptied what had accumulated. He simply lay in the bed he'd shared with Carolyn for so many years, waiting for it to be 5 of 7, quarter till anyway, so he could get up. Eventually he gave up even trying to drop off again. He simply lay there with his long-fingered, slightly swollen hands laced together on his chest, and stared up at the shadowy ceiling with eyes that felt as big as doorknobs. Sometimes he thought of Dr. Jamal down there in Westport, talking in a soft and comforting Indian accent, building up his little piece of the American dream. Sometimes he thought of places he and Carolyn had gone in the old days, and the one he kept coming back to was a hot afternoon at Sand Beach in Bar Harbor, the two of them sitting at a picnic table in their bathing suits, sitting under a big bright umbrella, eating sweet fried clams and drinking bud from long-neck bottles as they watched the sailboats scudding across the dark blue ocean. When had that been? 1964? 1967? Did it matter? Probably not. The alterations in his sleep schedule wouldn't have mattered either if they had ended there. Ralph would have adapted to the changes not just with ease, but with gratitude. All the books he hunted through that summer seemed to confirm one bit of folk wisdom he'd heard all his life. People slept less as they got older. If losing an hour or so a night was the only fee he had to pay for the dubious pleasure of being 70 years young, he would pay it gladly and consider himself well off. But it didn't end there. By the first week of May, Ralph was waking up to birdsong at 5:15 a.m. He tried earplugs for a few nights, although he doubted from the outset that they would work. It wasn't the newly returned birds that were waking him up, nor the occasional delivery truck backfire out on Harris Avenue. He'd always been the sort of guy who could sleep in the middle of a brass marching band, and he didn't think that had changed. What had changed was inside his head. There was a switch in there. Something was turning it on a little earlier each day, and Ralph hadn't the slightest idea of how to keep it from happening. By June, he was popping out of sleep like Jack out of his box at 4:30 a.m., 4:45 at the latest. And by the middle of July, not quite as hot as July of 92, but bad enough, thanks very much, he was snapping to at around 4 o'clock. It was during those long, hot nights, taking up too little of the bed where he and Carolyn had made love on so many hot nights, and cold ones, that he began to consider what a hell his life would become if sleep departed entirely. In daylight, he was still able to scoff at the notion, but he was discovering certain dismal truths about F. Scott Fitzgerald's Dark Night of the Soul, and the grand prize winner was this. At 4:15 a.m., anything seems possible. Anything. During the days, he was able to go on telling himself that he was simply experiencing a readjustment of his sleep cycle, that his body was responding in perfectly normal fashion to a number of big changes in his life. Retirement and the loss of his wife being the two biggest. He sometimes used the word loneliness when he thought about his new life, but he shied away from the dreaded D word, stuffing it back into the deep closet of his subconscious whenever it happened to glimmer for a moment in his thoughts. Loneliness was okay. Depression most certainly was not. Maybe you need to get more exercise, he thought. Do some walking, like you used to last summer. After all, you've been leading a pretty sedentary life. Get up, eat toast, read a book, watch some TV, get a sandwich across the street in the Red Apple for lunch, potter around in the garden a little, maybe go to the library, or visit with Helen and the baby if they happen to be out. Eat supper, maybe sit on the porch and visit with McGovern or Lois Chass for a while. Then what? Read a little more, watch a little more TV, wash up, go to bed. Sedentary. Boring. No wonder you wake up early. Except that was crap. His life sounded sedentary, yes, no doubt, but it really wasn't. The garden was a good example. What he did out there was never going to win him any prizes, but it was a hell of a long way from pottering around. Most afternoons he weeded until sweat made a dark tree shape down the back of his shirt and spread damp circles at his armpits. And he was often trembling with exhaustion by the time he let himself go back inside. Punishment probably would have been closer to the mark than pottering. But punishment for what? Waking up before dawn? Ralph didn't know and didn't care. Working in the garden filled up a large piece of the afternoon. It took his mind off things he didn't really care to think of. And that was enough to justify the aching muscles and the occasional flights of black spots in front of his eyes. He began his extended visits to the garden shortly after the 4th of July and continued all through August, long after the early crops had been harvested and the later ones had been hopelessly stunted by the lack of rain. "You ought to quit that," Bill McGovern told him one night as they sat on the porch drinking lemonade. This was in mid-August, and Ralph had begun to wake up around 3:30 each morning. "It's got to be hazardous to your health. Worse, you look like a lunatic." "Maybe I am a lunatic," Ralph responded shortly, and either his tone or the look in his eyes must have been convincing, because McGovern changed the subject. He did begin walking again, nothing like the marathons of 92, but he usually managed 2 miles a day if it wasn't raining. His usual route took him down the perversely named Up Mile Hill to the Derry Public Library and then on to Back Pages, a used bookstore and newsstand on the corner of Witcham and Main. Back Pages stood next to a jumbled junkatorium called Secondhand Rows, Secondhand Clothes. And as he passed this store one day during the August of his discontent, Ralph saw a new poster among the announcements of outdated bean suppers and ancient church socials, placed so it covered roughly half of a yellowing Pat Buchanan for President placard. The woman in the two photographs at the top of the poster was a pretty blonde in her late 30s or early 40s. But the style of the photos, unsmiling full face on the left, unsmiling profile on the right, plain white background in both, was unsettling enough to stop Ralph in his tracks. The photos made the woman look as if she belonged on a post office wall or in a TV docudrama. And that, the poster's printed matter made clear, was no accident. The photos were what stopped him, but it was the woman's name that held him. Wanted for murder, Susan Edwina Day, was printed across the top in big black letters, and below the simulated mugshots in red, "Stay out of our city." There was a small line of print at the very bottom of the poster. Ralph's close vision had deteriorated quite a bit since Carolyn's death. Gone to hell in a handbasket might actually have been a more accurate way of putting it, and he had to lean forward until his brow was pressed against the dirty show window of second-hand rose, second-hand clothes, before he could decipher it. Paid for by the Maine Life Watch Committee. Far down in his mind, a voice whispered, "Hey, hey, Susan Day, how many kids did you kill today?" Susan Day, Ralph recalled, was a political activist from either New York or Washington, the sort of fast-speaking woman who regularly drove taxi drivers, barbers, and hard-hat construction workers into foaming frenzies. Why that particular little jangle of doggerel had come into his mind, however, he couldn't say. It was tagged to some memory that wouldn't quite come. Maybe his tired old brains were just cross-referencing that 60s Vietnam protest chant, the one which had gone, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" No, that's not it, he thought. Close, but no cigar. It was... Just before his mind could cough up Ed Deepnose's name and face, a voice spoke from almost beside him. "Earth to Ralph, Earth to Ralph, come in, Ralphie, baby." Roused out of his thoughts, Ralph turned toward the voice. He was both shocked and amused to find he had almost been asleep on his feet. Christ, he thought, you never know how important sleep is until you miss a little. Then all the floors start to tilt, and all the corners on things start to round off. It was Hamilton Davenport, the proprietor of Back Pages, who had spoken to him. He was stocking the library cart he kept in front of his shop with brightly jacketed paperbacks. His old corncob pipe, to Ralph had always looked like the stack of a model steamship, jutted from the corner of his mouth, sending little puffs of blue smoke into the hot, bright air. Winston Smith, his old gray tomcat, sat in the open doorway of the shop with his tail curled around his paws. He looked at Ralph with yellow-eyed indifference, as if to say, "You think you know old, my friend? I'm here to testify you don't know dick about getting old." "Sheesh, Ralph," Davenport said. "I must have called your name at least 3 times. "I guess I was wool gathering," Ralph said. He stepped past the library cart, leaned in the doorway. Winston Smith held his place with regal indifference and grabbed the 2 papers he bought every day, a Boston Globe and a USA Today. The Derry News came right to the house, courtesy of Pat, the paperboy. He sometimes told people that he was sure one of the 3 papers was Comic Relief, but he'd never been able to make up his mind which one it was. "I haven't..." He broke off as Ed Deepnose's face came into his mind. It was Ed he'd heard that nasty little chant from. Last summer, out by the airport. And it really wasn't any wonder it had taken him a little while to retrieve the memory. Ed Deepnose was the last person in the world from whom you'd expect to hear something like that. "Ralphie," Davenport said, "you just shut down on me." Ralph blinked. "Oh, sorry, I haven't been sleeping very well. That's what I started to say." "Bummer, but there are worse problems. Just drink a glass of warm milk and listen to some quiet music 30 minutes before bed." Ralph had begun to discover this summer that everyone in America apparently had a pet remedy for insomnia, some bit of bedtime magic that had been handed down through the generations like the family Bible. Bach's good, also Beethoven, and William Ackerman ain't bad. But the real trick, Davenport raised one finger impressively to emphasize this, is not to get up from your chair during that 30 minutes. Not for anything. Don't answer the phone. Don't wind up the dog and put out the alarm clock. Don't decide to brush your teeth. Nothing. Then when you do go to bed, bam, out like a light. What if you're sitting there in your favorite easy chair and all at once you realize you have a call of nature? Ralph asked. These things can come on pretty suddenly when you get to be my age. Do it in your pants, Davenport said promptly and burst out laughing. Ralph smiled, but it had a dutiful feel. His insomnia was rapidly losing whatever marginal humor value it might once have had. In your pants, Ham chortled. He slapped the library cart and wagged his head back and forth. Ralph happened to glance down at the cat. Winston Smith looked blandly back at him, and to Ralph his calm yellow gaze seemed to say, "Yes, that's right. He's a fool, but he's my fool."
Not bad, huh? Hamilton Davenport, master of the snappy comeback. Do it in your... He snorted laughter, shook his head, then took the $2 bills Ralph was holding out. He slipped them into the pocket of his short red apron and came out with some change. That about right?
You bet. Thanks, Ham.
Uh-huh. And all joking aside, try the music. It really works. Mellows out your brain waves or something.
I will.
And the devil of it was, he probably would, as he had already tried Mrs. Rappaport's lemon and hot water recipe, and Shauna McClure's advice on how to clear his mind by slowing his respiration and concentrating on the word cool. Except when Shauna said it, the word came out cool. When you were trying to deal with a slow but relentless erosion of your good sleep time, any folk remedy started to look good. Ralph started to turn away, then turned back. What's with that poster next door? Ham Davenport wrinkled his nose. Dan Dalton's place? I don't look in there at all if I can help it. Screws up my appetite. Has he got something new and disgusting in the window? I guess it's new. It's not as yellow as the rest of them. And there's a notable lack of fly dirt on it. Looks like a wanted poster, only it's Susan Day in the photos. Susan Day on a... Son of a bitch. He cast a dark and humorless look at the shop next door. What is she, president of the National Organization of Women or something? Ex-president, and co-founder of Sisters in Arms, author of My Mother's Shadow and Lilies of the Valley. That one's a study of battered women and why so many of them refuse to blow the whistle on the men that batter them. She won a Pulitzer Prize for it, I think. Susie Day is one of the three or four most politically influential women in America right now, and she can really write as well as think. That clown knows I've got one of her petitions sitting right by my cash register. What petitions? We're trying to get her up here to speak, Davenport said. You know, the Right to Life has tried to firebomb woman care last Christmas, right? Ralph cast his mind cautiously back into the black pit he'd been living in at the end of 1992 and said, Well, I remember that the cops caught some guy in the hospital's long-term parking lot with a can of gasoline, but I didn't know. And that was Charlie Pickering. He's a member of Daily Bread, one of the Right to Life groups that keep the pickets marching out there, Davenport said. They put him up to it, too, take my word. This year they're not bothering with gasoline, though. They're going to try to get the city council to change the zoning regulations and squeeze woman care right out of existence. They just might do it, too. You know Derry, Ralph. It's not exactly a hotbed of liberalism. No, Ralph said with a wan smile. It's never been that. And woman care is an abortion clinic, isn't it? Davenport gave him an out-of-patience look and jerked his head in the direction of Secondhand Rows. That's what assholes like him call it, he said. Only they like to use the word mill instead of clinic. They ignore all the other stuff woman care does. To Ralph, Davenport had begun to sound a little like the TV announcer who hawked run-free pantyhose during the Sunday afternoon movie. They're involved in family counseling, they deal with spouse and child abuse, and they run a shelter for abused women over by the Newport Town Line. They have a rape crisis center at the in-town building by the hospital, and a 24-hour hotline for women who've been raped or beaten. In short, they stand for all the things that make Marlboro men like Dalton shit bullets. But they do perform abortions, Ralph said. That's what the pickets are about, right? There had been sign-carrying demonstrators in front of the low-slung, unobtrusive brick building that housed woman care for years.
it seemed to Ralph. They always looked too pale to him, too intense, too skinny or too fat, too utterly sure that God was on their side. The signs they carried said things like, "The unborn have rights too," and "Life, what a beautiful choice," and that all stand by, "Abortion is murder." On several occasions, women using the clinic, which was near Derry Home but not actually associated with it, Ralph thought, had been struck with baggies containing Karo syrup, which had been dyed red. "Yeah, they perform abortions," Ham said. "You got a problem with that?" Ralph thought of all the years he and Carolyn had tried to have a baby, years that had produced nothing but several false alarms and a single messy 5 months miscarriage, and shrugged. Suddenly the day seemed too hot and his legs too tired. The thought of his return journey, the up-mile hill leg of it in particular, hung in the back of his mind like something strung from a line of fish hooks. "Christ, I don't know," he said. "I just wish people didn't have to get so shrill." Davenport grunted, walked over to his neighbor's display window, and peered at the bogus wanted poster. While he was looking at it, a tall, pallid man with a goatee, the absolute antithesis of the Marlboro man, Ralph would have said, materialized from the gloomy depths of second-hand rows like a vaudeville spook that has gotten a bit moldy around the edges. He saw what Davenport was looking at, and a tiny, disdainful smile dimpled the corners of his mouth. Ralph thought it was the kind of smile that could cost a man a couple of teeth or a broken nose, especially on a dog-hot day like this one. Davenport pointed at the poster and shook his head violently. Dalton's smile deepened. He flapped his hands at Davenport. "Who gives a shit what you think?" the gesture said, and then disappeared back into the depths of his store. Davenport returned to Ralph, bright spots of color burning in his cheeks. "That man's picture should be next to the word prick in the dictionary," he said. "Exactly what he thinks about you, I imagine," Ralph thought, but of course did not say. Davenport stood in front of the library cart full of paperbacks, hands stuffed into his pockets beneath his red change apron, brooding at the poster of, Hey, Susan Day. "Well," Ralph said, "I suppose I better..." Davenport shook himself out of his brown study. "Don't go yet," he said. "Sign my petition first, will you? Put a little shine back on my morning." Ralph shifted his feet uncomfortably. "I usually don't get involved in confrontational stuff like..." "Come on, Ralph," Davenport said in a let's-be-reasonable voice. "We're not talking confrontation here. We're talking about making sure that the fruits and nuts, like the ones who run Daily Bread, and political Neanderthals like Dalton, don't shut down a really useful women's resource center. It's not like I'm asking you to endorse testing chemical warfare weapons on dolphins." "No," Ralph said, "I suppose not. We're hoping to send 5,000 signatures to Susan Day by the 1st of September. Probably won't do any good. Derry's really not much more than a wide place on the road, and she's probably booked into the next century anyhow. But it can't hurt to try." Ralph thought about telling Ham that the only petition he wanted to sign was one asking the gods of sleep to give him back the 3 hours or so of good rest a night they had stolen away. But then he took another look at the man's face and decided against it. Carolyn would have signed his damn petition, he thought. She was no fan of abortion, but she was also no fan of men coming home after the bars closed and mistaking their wives and kids for soccer balls. True enough, but that wouldn't have been her main reason for signing. She would have done it on the off chance that she might get to hear an authentic firebrand like Susan Day up close and in person. She would have done it out of the ingrained curiosity which had perhaps been her dominating characteristic. Something so strong, not even the brain tumor had been able to kill it. 2 days before she died, she had pulled the movie ticket he'd been using as a bookmark out of the paperback novel he'd left on her bedside table, because she had wanted to know what he'd been to see. It had been Tom Cruise in A Few Good Men, as a matter of fact. And he was both surprised and dismayed to discover how much it hurt to remember that. Even now it hurt like hell. "Sure," he told Ham, "I'll be happy to sign it." "My man," Davenport exclaimed, and clapped him on the shoulder. The broody look was replaced by a grin, But Ralph didn't think the change much of an improvement. The grin was hard and not especially charming.
Step into my den of iniquity.
Ralph followed him into the tobacco-smelling shop, which did not seem particularly iniquitous at 9:30 in the morning. Winston Smith fled before them, pausing just once to look back with his ancient yellow eyes.
"He's a fool, and you're another," that parting stare might have said.
Under the circumstances, it wasn't a conclusion Ralph felt much inclined to dispute. He tucked his newspapers under his arm, leaned over the ruled sheet on the counter beside the cash register, and signed the petition asking Susan Day to come to Derry and speak in defense of woman care. He did better climbing up Mile Hill than he had expected, and crossed the X-shaped intersection of Witcham and Jackson, thinking, "There, that wasn't so bad, was?" He suddenly realized that his ears were ringing, and his legs had begun to tremble beneath him. He stopped on the far side of Witcham and placed one hand against his shirt. He could feel his heart beating just beneath it, pumping away with a ragged fierceness that was scary. He heard a papery rustle, and saw an advertising supplement slip out of the Boston Globe and go seesawing down into the gutter. He started to bend over and get it, then stopped. "Not a good idea, Ralph. If you bend over, you're more than likely going to fall over. I suggest you leave that one for the sweeper." "Yeah, okay, good idea," he muttered and straightened up. Black dots surged across his vision like a surreal flock of crows, and for a moment, Ralph was almost positive he was going to wind up lying on top of the ad supplement, no matter what he did or didn't do. "Ralph, you all right?" He looked up cautiously and saw Lois Chass, who lived on the other side of Harris Avenue and half a block down from the house he shared with Bill McGovern. She was sitting on one of the benches just outside Strawford Park, probably waiting for the Canal Street bus to come along and take her downtown. "Sure, fine," he said, and made his legs move. He felt as if he were walking through syrup, but he thought he got over to the bench without looking too bad. He could not, however, suppress a grateful little gasp as he sat down next to her. Lois Chass had large dark eyes, the kind that had been called Spanish eyes when Ralph was a kid, and he bet they had danced through the minds of dozens of boys during Lois's high school years. They were still her best feature, but Ralph didn't much care for the worry he saw in them now. It was, what? A little too neighborly for comfort was the first thought to occur to him, but he wasn't sure it was the right thought. "Fine," Lois echoed. "You betcha." He took his handkerchief from his back pocket, checked to make sure it was clean, and then wiped his brow with it. "I hope you don't mind me saying it, Ralph, but you don't look fine." Ralph did mind her saying it, but didn't know how to say so. "You're pale. You're sweating. And you're a litterbug." Ralph looked at her, startled. "Something fell out of your paper. I think it was an ad circular." "Did it?" "You know perfectly well it did." "Excuse me a second." She got up, crossed the sidewalk, bent. Ralph noticed that while her hips were fairly broad, her legs were still admirably trim for a woman who had to be at least 68, and picked up the circular. She came back to the bench with it and sat down. "There," she said. "Now you're not a litter bug anymore." He smiled in spite of himself. "Thank you." "Don't mention it. I can use the Maxwell House coupon, also the hamburger helper and the Diet Coke. I've gotten so fat since Mr. Chass died." "You're not a bit fat, Lois." "Thank you, Ralph. You're a perfect gentleman, but let's not change the subject. You had a dizzy spell, didn't you? In fact, you almost passed out." "I was just catching my breath," he said stiffly, and turned to watch a bunch of kids playing scrub baseball just inside the park. They were going at it hard, laughing and grab-assing around. Ralph envied the efficiency of their air conditioning systems. "Catching your breath, were you?"
"Yes."
"Just catching your breath?"
"Lois, you're starting to sound like a broken record."
"Well, the broken record's going to tell you something, okay?" "You're nuts to be trying up Mile Hill in this heat. If you want to walk, why not go out the extension where it's flat, like you used to?" "Because it makes me think of Carolyn," he said. not liking the stiff, almost rude way that sounded, but unable to help it. "Oh, shit," she said, and touched his hand briefly. "Sorry." "It's okay." "No, it's not. I should have known better. But the way you look just now, that's not okay either. You're not 20 anymore, Ralph, not even 40. I don't mean you're not in good shape. Anyone can see you're in great shape for a guy your age. But you ought to take better care of yourself. Carolyn would want you to take care of yourself." "I know," he said, "but I'm really..." "All right," he meant to finish. And then he looked up from his hands, looked into her dark eyes again, and what he saw there made it impossible to finish for a moment. There was weariness in her eyes as well, he saw. Or was it loneliness? Maybe it was both. In any case, those were not the only things he saw in them. He also saw himself. "You're being silly," the eyes looking into his said. "Maybe we both are. You're 70 and a widower, Ralph. I'm 68 and a widow. How long are we going to sit on your porch in the evenings with Bill McGovern as the world's oldest chaperone? Not too long, I hope, because neither of us are exactly fresh off the showroom lot." "Ralph," Lois asked, suddenly concerned, "are you okay?" "Yes," he said, looking down at his hands again. "Yes, sure." "You had a look on your face like... well, I don't know." Ralph wondered if maybe the combination of the heat and the walk up Mile Hill had scrambled his brains a little. Because this was Lois, after all, whom McGovern always referred to with a small satiric lift of his left eyebrow as our Lois. And okay, yes, she was still in good shape, trim legs, nice bust, and those remarkable eyes. And maybe he wouldn't mind taking her to bed. And maybe she wouldn't mind being taken. But what would there be after that? If she happened to see a ticket stub poking out of the book he was reading, would she pull it out? Too curious about what movie he'd been to see to think about how she was losing his place? Ralph thought not. Lois's eyes were remarkable, and he had found his own eyes wandering down the V of her blouse more than once as the three of them sat on the front porch drinking iced tea in the cool of the evening. But he had an idea that your little head could get your big head in trouble even at 70. Getting old was no excuse to get careless. He got to his feet, aware of Lois looking at him and making an extra effort not to stoop. "Thanks for your concern," he said. "Want to walk an old fella up the street?" "Thanks, but I'm going downtown. They've got some beautiful rose-colored yarn in at the sewing circle, and I'm thinking Afghan. Meanwhile, I'll just wait for the bus and gloat over my coupons." Ralph grinned. "You do that." He glanced over at the kids on the scrub ball field. As he watched, a boy with an extravagant mop of red hair broke from third, threw himself down in a head-first slide, and fetched up against one of the catcher's shin guards with an audible thunk. Ralph winced, envisioning ambulances with flashing lights and screaming sirens. But the carrot top bounced to his feet, laughing. "Missed the tag, you hoser!" he shouted. "The hell I did," the catcher responded indignantly. But then he began to laugh, too. "Ever wish you were that age again, Ralph?" Lois asked. He thought it over. "Sometimes," he said. "Mostly it just looks too strenuous." "Come on over tonight, Lois. Sit with us a while." "I might just do that," she said. And Ralph started up Harris Avenue, feeling the weight of her remarkable eyes on him and trying hard to keep his back straight. He thought he managed fairly well, but it was hard work. He had never felt so tired in his life. Ralph made the appointment to see Dr. Litchfield less than an hour after his conversation with Lois on the park bench. The receptionist with a cool, sexy voice told him she could fit him in next Tuesday morning at 10 if that was okay, and Ralph told her that was fine as paint. Then he hung up, went into the living room, sat in the wing chair that overlooked Harris Avenue, and thought about how Dr. Litchfield had initially treated his wife's brain tumor with Tylenol 3. And pamphlets explaining various relaxation techniques. From there, he moved on to the look he'd seen in Litchfield's eyes after the magnetic resonance imaging tests had confirmed the CAT scan's bad news. That look of guilt and unease. Across the street, a bunch of kids who would soon be back in school came out of the Red Apple armed with candy bars and Slurpees. As Ralph watched them mount their bikes and tear away into the bright 11 o'clock heat, he thought what he'd always did when the memory of Dr. Litchfield's eyes surfaced. That it was most likely a false memory. The thing is, old buddy, you wanted Litchfield to look uneasy. But even more than that, you wanted him to look guilty. Quite possibly true. Quite possibly Carl Litchfield was a peach of a guy and a hell of a doctor. But Ralph still found himself calling Litchfield's office again half an hour later. He told the receptionist with a sexy voice that he'd just rechecked his calendar and discovered next Tuesday at 10 wasn't so fine after all. He'd made an appointment with a podiatrist for that day and forgotten all about it. "My memory's not what it used to be," Ralph told her. The receptionist suggested next Thursday at 2. Ralph countered by promising to call back. Liar, liar, pants on fire, he thought as he hung up the phone, walked slowly back to the wing chair and lowered himself into it. You're done with him, aren't you? He supposed he was. Not that Dr. Litchfield was apt to lose any sleep over it. If he thought about Ralph at all, it would be as one less old geezer to fart in his face during the prostate exam. All right, so what are you going to do about the insomnia, Ralph? Sit quiet for half an hour before bedtime and listen to classical music, he said out loud. Buy some Depends for those troublesome calls of nature. He startled himself by laughing at the image of himself sitting solemnly in his chair, wearing nothing but a pair of adult disposable diapers, and listening to Bach. The laughter had a hysterical edge he didn't much care for. It was damn creepy, as a matter of fact, but it was still a little while before he could make himself stop. Yet he supposed he would try Hamilton Davenport's suggestion, although he would skip the diapers, thank you, as he had tried most of the folk remedies well-meaning people had passed on to him. This made him think of his first bona fide folk remedy, and that raised another grin. It had been McGovern's idea. He'd been sitting on the porch one evening when Ralph came back from the Red Apple with some noodles and spaghetti sauce, had taken one look at his upstairs neighbor and made a tisk-tisk sound, shaking his head dolefully. "What's that supposed to mean?" Ralph asked, taking the seat next to him. A little further down the street, a little girl in jeans and an oversized white T-shirt had been skipping rope and chanting in a growing gloom. "It means you're looking folded, spindled, and mutilated," McGovern said. He used one thumb to tilt the Panama back on his head and looked more closely at Ralph. "Still not sleeping?" "Still not sleeping," Ralph agreed. McGovern was quiet for a few seconds. When he spoke again, he did so in a tone of absolute, almost apocalyptic, in fact, finality. "Whiskey is the answer," he said. "I beg your pardon?" "To your insomnia, Ralph. I don't mean you should take a bath in it. There's no need of that. Just mix a tablespoon of honey with half a shot of whiskey and hook it down 15 or 20 minutes before you hit the hay." "You think?" Ralph had asked hopefully. "All I can say is it worked for me, and I had some real problems sleeping around the time I turned 40. Looking back on it, I guess that was my midlife crisis. 6 months of insomnia and a year-long depression over my bald spot." Although the books he'd been consulting all said that booze was a vastly overrated cure for sleeplessness, that it often made the problem worse instead of better, in fact, he had tried it just the same. He'd never been much of a drinker, so he began by adjusting McGovern's recommended half-shot dosage down to a quarter of a shot. But after a week of no relief, he had upped the ante to a full shot, then to two. He woke up one morning at 4:22 with a nasty little headache to accompany the dull brown taste of early times on the roof of his mouth, and realized he was suffering his first hangover in 15 years. "Life's too short for this shit," he had announced to his empty apartment, and that had been the end of the great whiskey experiment. Okay, Ralph thought now as he watched the desultory mid-morning flow of customers in and out of the Red Apple across the street. "Here's the situation. McGovern says you look like shit. You almost fainted at Lois Chass's feet this morning, and you just canceled the appointment you made with ye old family physician. So what next? Just let it go? Accept the situation and let it go? The idea had a certain oriental charm. Fate, karma, and all that. But he was going to need more than charm to get him through the long hours of early morning. The book said there were people in the world, quite a lot of them, who managed very well on no more than 3 or 4 hours of sleep a night. There were even some who got along on only 2. They were an extremely small minority, but they did exist. Ralph Roberts, however, was not among their number. How he looked wasn't very important to him. He had a feeling that his matinee idol days were well behind him. But how he felt was, and it was no longer just a matter of not feeling good. He felt horrible. The insomnia had begun to pervade every aspect of his life, the way the smell of frying garlic on the 5th floor will eventually pervade an entire apartment building. The color had started to drain out of things. The world had begun to take on the dull, grainy quality of a newspaper photograph. Simple decisions, whether to heat up a frozen dinner for his evening meal, or grab a sandwich at the Red Apple and go up to the picnic area by runway 3, for example, had become difficult, almost agonizing. In the last couple of weeks, he had found himself coming back to the apartment from Dave's video stop, empty-handed more and more often. Not because there was nothing at Dave's he wanted to watch, but because there was too much. He couldn't decide if he wanted one of the Dirty Harry movies, or a Billy Crystal comedy, or maybe a few old Star Trek episodes. After a couple of these unsuccessful trips, he had plopped himself down in this very wing chair, almost crying with frustration, and he supposed fear. That creeping sensory numbness and the erosion of his decision-making capabilities were not the only problems he had come to associate with the insomnia. His short-term memory had also begun to slip. It had been his practice to go to the movies at least once and sometimes twice a week, ever since his retirement from the print shop where he had finished his working life as the bookkeeper and general supervisor. He'd taken Carolyn until last year, when she had gotten too sick to enjoy going out anywhere. After her death, he had mostly gone alone, although Helen Deepnow had accompanied him once or twice when Ed was home to mind the baby. Ed himself almost never went, claiming he got headaches at the movies. Ralph had gotten so used to calling the cinema center's answering machine to check showtimes that he'd had the number by heart. As the summer went on, however, he found himself having to look it up in the yellow pages more and more often. He could no longer be sure if the last 4 digits were 1317 or 1713. "It's 1713," he said now. "I know it is." But did he know it? Did he really? "Call Litchfield back. Go on, Ralph. Stop sifting through the wreckage. Do something constructive. And if Litchfield really sticks in your craw, call somebody else. The phone book's as full of doctors as it ever was." Probably true, but 70 was maybe a little old to be picking a new sawbones by the eeny, meeny, miny, moe method. And he wasn't going to call Litchfield back, period. "Okay, so what's next, you stubborn old goat? A few more folk remedies?" "I hope not, because at the rate you're going, you'll be down to Eye of Newt and Tongue of Toad in no time." The answer that came was like a cool breeze on a hot day, and it was an absurdly simple answer. All his book research this summer had been aimed at understanding the problem rather than finding a solution. When it came to answers, he had relied almost solely on backfence remedies like whiskey and honey, even when the books had already assured him they probably wouldn't work or would only work for a while. Although the books did offer some presumably reliable methods for coping with insomnia, the only one Ralph had actually tried was the simplest and most obvious, going to bed earlier in the evening. That solution hadn't worked. He had simply lain awake until 11:30 or so, then dropped off to wake at his new, earlier time. But something else might. It was worth a try anyway. Instead of spending the afternoon in his usual frenzy of backyard pottering, Ralph went down to the library and skimmed through some of the books he had already looked at. The general consensus seemed to be that if going to bed earlier didn't work, going later might. Ralph went home, mindful of his earlier adventures he took the bus, filled with cautious hope. it might work. If it didn't, he always had Bach, Beethoven, and William Ackerman to fall back on. His first attempt at this technique, which one of the texts called delayed sleep, was comic. He awoke at his now usual time, 3:45 by the digital clock on the living room mantel, with a sore back, an aching neck, no immediate idea of how he'd gotten into the wing chair by the window, or why the TV was on, broadcasting nothing but snow and a soft, surf-like roar of static. It was only as he allowed his head to roll cautiously back, supporting the nape of his neck with a cupped palm, that he realized what had happened. He had intended to sit up until at least 3 o'clock and possibly 4. He would then stroll off to bed and sleep the sleep of the just. That had been the plan, anyway. Instead, the incredible insomniac of Harris Avenue had dropped off during Jay Leno's opening monologue, like a kid who's trying to stay up all night long just to see what it's like. And then, of course, he had finished the adventure by waking up at his now usual time. The problem was the same, Joe Friday might have said, only the location had changed. Ralph strolled off to bed anyway, hoping against hope, but the urge, if not the need to sleep, had passed. After an hour of lying awake, he had gone back to the wing chair again, this time with a pillow propped behind his stiff neck and a rueful grin on his face. There was nothing funny about his second try, which took place the following night. Sleepiness began to steal over him at his usual time, 11:20, just as Pete Cherney was giving the following day's weather forecast. This time Ralph fought it successfully, making it all the way through Whoopi, although he almost nodded off during Whoopi's conversation with Roseanne Arnold, that evening's guest, and the late-night movie that came on after that. It was an old Audie Murphy flick, in which Audie appeared to be winning the war in the Pacific pretty much single-handed. It sometimes seemed to Ralph that there was an unspoken rule among local TV broadcasters which stated that movies telecast in the small hours of the morning could only star Audie Murphy or James Brolin. After the last Japanese pillbox had been blown up, Channel 2 signed off. Ralph dialed around, looking for another movie, and found nothing but snow. He supposed he could have watched movies all night if he had the cable, like Bill downstairs or Lois down the street. He remembered having put that on his list of things to do in the new year. But then Carolyn had died, and cable TV, with or without home box office, had no longer seemed very important. He found a copy of Sports Illustrated and began to slog through an article on women's tennis he'd missed the first time through, glancing up at the clock every now and then as the hands began to close in on 3 a.m. He'd become all but convinced that this was going to work. His eyelids were so heavy they felt as if they had been dipped in concrete, and although he was reading the tennis article carefully, word for word, he had no idea of what the writer was driving at. Whole sentences zipped across his brain without sticking, like cosmic rays. "I'm going to sleep tonight. I really think I am. For the first time in months, the sun is going to have to come up without my help. And that isn't just good, friends and neighbors. That is great." Then shortly after 3 o'clock, that pleasant drowsiness began to disappear. It did not go with a champagne cork pop, but rather seemed to ooze away, like sand through a fine sieve or water down a partially clogged drain. When Ralph realized what was happening, it wasn't panic he felt, but sick dismay. It was a feeling he had come to recognize as the true opposite of hope. And when he slipper-scuffed his way into the bedroom at 3:15, he couldn't remember a depression as deep as the one which now enveloped him. He felt as if he was suffocating in it. "Please, God, just 40 winks," he muttered as he turned off the light. But he strongly suspected that this was one prayer which was not going to be answered. It wasn't. Although he had been awake for 24 hours by then, every trace of sleepiness had left his mind and body by 4:15. He was tired. Yes, more deeply and fundamentally tired than he'd ever been in his life. But being tired and being sleepy, he had discovered, were sometimes poles apart. Sleep, that undiscriminating friend, humankind's best and most reliable nurse since the dawn of time, had abandoned him again. By 4 o'clock, Ralph's bed had become hateful to him, as it always did when he realized he could put it to no good use. He swung his feet back onto the floor, scratching the mat of hair, almost entirely gray now, which curled through his mostly unbuttoned pajama top. He slid on his slippers again and scuffed back to the living room, where he dropped into the wingback chair and looked down at Harris Avenue. It was laid out like a stage set, where the only actor currently on view wasn't even human. It was a stray dog moving slowly down Harris Avenue in the direction of Strawford Park and up Mile Hill. It held its left rear leg up as much as possible, limping along as best it could on the other three. "Hi there, Rosalie," Ralph muttered, and rubbed a hand across his eyes. It was a Thursday morning, garbage pickup day on Harris Avenue, so he wasn't surprised to see Rosalie, who'd been a wandering here and there fixture in the neighborhood for the last year or so. She made her way down the street in leisurely fashion, investigating the rows and clusters of cans with the discrimination of a jaded flea market shopper. Now Rosalie, who was limping worse than ever this morning, and looked as tired as Ralph felt, found what looked like a good-sized beef bone and trotted away with it in her mouth. Ralph watched her out of sight, then simply sat with his hands folded in his lap, gazing out on the silent neighborhood where the orange high-intensity lamps added to the illusion that Harris Avenue was nothing but a stage set, standing deserted after the evening performance had ended and the actors had gone home. They shone down like spotlights in a perfect diminishing perspective that was surreal and hallucinatory. Ralph Roberts sat in the wing chair where he had spent so many early morning hours lately and waited for light and movement to invest the lifeless world below him. Finally, the first human actor, Pat the Paperboy, entered stage right, riding his Rory. He biked his way up the street, tossing rolled newspapers from the bag slung over his shoulder, and hitting the porches he aimed at with a fair degree of accuracy. Ralph watched him a while, then heaved a sigh which felt as if it had come all the way from the basement, and got up to make tea. "I don't remember ever reading about this shit in my horoscope," he said hollowly, and then turned on the kitchen tap and began to fill the kettle. Long Thursday morning and even longer Thursday afternoon taught Roberts a valuable lesson. Not to sneer at 3 or 4 hours sleep a night simply because he had spent his entire life under the mistaken impression that he had a right to at least 6 and usually 7. It also served as a hideous preview. If things didn't improve, he could look forward to feeling like this most of the time. Hell, all of the time. He went into the bedroom at 10 o'clock and again at 1, hoping for a little nap. Even a cat nap would do, and half an hour would be a lifesaver. But he could not so much as drowse. He was miserably tired, but not in the least bit sleepy. Around 3 o'clock, he decided to make himself a Lipton cup of soup. He filled the tea kettle with fresh water, put it on to boil, and opened the cupboard over the counter where he kept condiments, spices, and various envelopes containing foods which only astronauts and old men actually seem to eat. Powders to which the consumer needs only add hot water. He pushed cans and bottles around in aimless fashion, and then simply stared into the cupboard for a while, as if expecting the box of soup packets to magically appear in the space he had made. When they didn't, he would repeat the process, only this time moving things back to their original positions before staring in again with a look of distant perplexity, which was becoming, Ralph mercifully did not know this, his dominant expression. When the tea kettle shrieked, he put it on one of the rear burners and went back to staring into the cupboard. It dawned on him, very, very slowly, that he must have drunk his last packet of cup of soup yesterday or the day before, although he could not for the life of him remember doing so. "That's a surprise," he asked the boxes and bottles in the open cupboard. "I'm so tired I can't remember my own name." "Yes, I can," he thought. "It's Leon Redbone. So there." It wasn't much of a joke, but he felt a small smile, it felt as light as a feather, touch his lips. He stepped into the bathroom, combed his hair, and then went downstairs. "Here's Audie Murphy heading out into enemy territory in search of supplies," he thought. "Primary target? 1 box of Lipton chicken rice cup of soup packets. If locating and securing this target should prove impossible, I'll divert to my secondary, noodles and beef. I know this is a risky mission, but... But I work best alone, he finished as he came out on the porch. Old Mrs. Perrine happened to be passing, and she favored Ralph with a sharp look, but said nothing. He waited for her to get a little way up the sidewalk. He did not feel capable of conversation with anyone this afternoon, least of all Mrs. Perrine, who at 82 could still have found stimulating and useful work among the Marines at Paris Island. He pretended to be examining the spider plant, which hung from the hook under the porch eave, until she had reached what he deemed a safe distance, then crossed Harris Avenue to the Red Apple, which was where the day's real troubles began. He entered the convenience store once again, mulling over the spectacular failure of the delayed sleep experiment, and wondering if the advice in the library texts was no more than an uptown version of the folk remedies his acquaintances seemed so eager to press upon him. It was an unpleasant idea, but he thought his mind, or the force below his mind, which was actually in charge of this slow torture, had sent him a message which was even more unpleasant. You have a sleep window, Ralph. It's not as big as it once was, and it seems to be getting smaller with every passing week, but you better be grateful for what you've got, because a small window is better than no window at all. You can see that now, don't you? Yes, Ralph mumbled as he walked down the center aisle to the bright red cup of soup boxes. I see that very well. Sue, the afternoon counter girl, laughed cheerfully. You must have money in the bank, Ralph, she said. Beg pardon? Ralph didn't turn. He was inventorying the red boxes. Here was onion, split pea, the beef and noodles combo. But where the hell was the chicken and rice? My mom always said people who talk to themselves have... Oh, my God! For a moment, Ralph thought she had simply made a statement a little too complex for his tired mind to immediately grasp. Something about how people who talked to themselves had found God. And then she screamed. He had hunkered down to check the boxes on the bottom shelf, and the scream shot him to his feet so hard and fast that his knees popped. He wheeled toward the front of the store, bumping the top shelf of the soup display with his elbow, and knocking half a dozen red boxes into the aisle. Sue? What's wrong? Sue paid no attention. She was looking out through the door with her fisted hands pressed against her lips and her brown eyes huge above them. God, look at the blood, she cried in a choked voice. Ralph turned further, knocking a few more Lipton boxes into the aisle, and looked through the Red Apple's dirty show window. What he saw drew a gasp from him, and it took him a space of seconds, five maybe, to realize that the bloody beaten woman staggering toward the Red Apple was Helen Deepnow. Ralph had always thought Helen the prettiest woman on the west side of town, but there was nothing pretty about her today. One of her eyes was puffed shut. There was a gash at her left temple that was soon going to be lost in the gaudy swelling of a fresh bruise. Her puffy lips and her cheeks were covered with blood. The blood had come from her nose, which was still leaking. She wove through the Red Apple's little parking lot toward the door like a drunk, her one good eye seeming to see nothing. It simply stared. More frightening than the way she looked was the way she was handling Natalie. She had the squalling, frightened baby slung casually on one hip, carrying her as she might have carried her books to high school 10 or 12 years before. Oh, Jesus, she's going to drop the kid, Sue screamed. But although she was 10 steps closer to the door than he was, she made no move, simply stood where she was with her hands pressed to her mouth and her eyes gobbling up her face. Ralph suddenly didn't feel tired anymore. He sprinted up the aisle, tore open the door, and ran outside. He was just in time to catch Helen by the shoulders as she banged a hip against the ice cabinet, mercifully not the hip with Natalie on it, and went veering off in a new direction. Helen, he yelled. Jesus, Helen, what happened? Huh? She asked, her voice dully curious, totally unlike the voice of the lively young woman who sometimes accompanied him to the movies and moaned over Mel Gibson. Her good eye rolled toward him, and he saw that same dull curiosity in it, a look that said she didn't know who she was, let alone where she was, or what had happened, or when. Huh? Ralph? What? The baby slipped. Ralph let go of Helen, grabbed for Natalie, and managed to snag one of her jumper straps. Nat screamed, waved her hands, and stared at him with huge dark blue eyes. He got his other hand between Nat's legs an instant before the strap he was holding tore free. For a moment, the howling baby balanced on his hand like a gymnast on a balance beam, and Ralph could feel the damp bulge of her diapers through the overall she was wearing. Then he slipped his other hand around her back and hoisted her up against his chest. His heart was pounding hard, and even with the baby safe in his arms, he kept seeing her slip away, kept seeing her head with its cap of fine downy hair slamming against the butt-lidded pavement with a sickening crack. "Huh? Huh? Ralph?" Helen asked. She saw Natalie in Ralph's arms, and some of the dullness went out of her good eye. She raised her hands toward the child, and in Ralph's arms, Natalie mimicked the gesture with her own chubby hands. Then Helen staggered, struck the side of the building, and reeled backward a step, one foot tangled in the other. Ralph saw splatters of blood on her small white sneakers, and it was amazing how bright everything was all of a sudden. The color had come back into the world, at least temporarily. And she would have fallen if Sue hadn't picked that moment to finally venture out. Instead of going down, Helen landed against the opening door and just leaned there like a drunk against a lamppost. "Ralph?" The expression in her eyes was a little sharper now, and Ralph saw it wasn't so much curiosity as incredulity. She drew in a deep breath and made an effort to force intelligible words past her swelled lips.
Give me my baby. Baby, give me Nally.
Not just yet, Helen, Ralph said. You're not too steady on your feet right now. Sue was still on the other side of the door, holding it so Helen wouldn't fall. The girl's cheeks and forehead were ashy pale, her eyes filled with tears. Get out here, Ralph told her. Hold her up.
I can't, she blubbered. She's all bloody.
Oh, for God's sake, quit it. It's Helen. Helen Deepnell from up the street. And although Sue must have known that, actually, hearing the name seemed to turn the trick. She slipped around the open door, and when Helen staggered backward again, Sue curled an arm around her shoulders and braced her firmly. That expression of incredulous surprise remained on Helen's face. Ralph found it harder and harder to look at. It made him feel sick to his stomach. Ralph? What happened? Was it an accident? He turned his head and saw Bill McGovern standing at the edge of the parking lot. He was wearing one of his natty blue shirts, with the iron's creases still in the sleeves, and holding one of his long-fingered, oddly delicate hands up to shade his eyes. He looked strange, somehow naked that way. But Ralph had no time to think about why. Too much was happening. It was no accident, he said. She's been beaten up. Here, take the kid. He held Natalie out to McGovern, who at first shrank back and then took the baby. Natalie immediately began to shriek again. McGovern, looking like someone who has just been handed an overfilled airsick bag, held her out at arm's length with her feet dangling. Behind him, a small crowd was beginning to gather, many of them teenage kids in baseball uniforms on their way home from an afternoon game at the field around the corner. They were staring at Helen's puffed and bloody face with an unpleasant avidity, and Ralph found himself thinking of the Bible story about the time Noah had gotten drunk on the ark. The good sons who had looked away from the naked old man lying on his pallet, the bad one who had looked, and laughed. Gently he replaced Sue's arm with his own. Helen's good eye rolled back to him. She said his name more clearly this time, more positively, and the gratitude Ralph heard in her blurry voice made him feel like crying. Sue, take the baby. Bill doesn't have a clue. She did, folding Nat gently and expertly into her arms. McGovern gave her a grateful smile, and Ralph suddenly realized what was wrong with the way he looked. McGovern wasn't wearing the Panama hat, which seemed as much a part of him, in the summertime at least, as the wind on the bridge of his nose. "Hey, mister, what happened?" one of the baseball kids asked.
"Nothing that's any of your business," Ralph said.
"Looks like she went a few rounds with Riddick Bowe." "Nah, Tyson," one of the other baseball kids said, and incredibly there was laughter. "Get out of here," Ralph shouted at them, suddenly furious. "Go peddle your papers. Mind your business." They shuffled back a few steps, but no one left. It was blood they were looking at, and not on a movie screen. "Helen, can you walk?"
"Yeah," she said. Think so."
He led her carefully around the open door and into the red apple. She moved slowly, shuffling from foot to foot like an old woman. The smell of sweat and spent adrenaline was baking out of her pores in a sour reek. And Ralph felt his stomach turn over again. It wasn't the smell, not really. It was the effort to reconcile this Helen with a pert and pleasantly sexy woman he had spoken to yesterday while she worked in her flower beds. Ralph suddenly remembered something else about yesterday. Helen had been wearing blue shorts, cut quite high, and he had noticed a couple of bruises on her legs. A large yellow blotch far up on the left thigh, a fresher, darker smudge on the right calf. He walked Helen toward the little office area behind the cash register. He glanced up into the convex anti-theft mirror mounted in the corner and saw McGovern holding the door for Sue. "Lock the door," he said over his shoulder.
"Gee, Ralph, I'm not supposed to."
"Just for a couple of minutes," Ralph said. "Please."
"Well, okay, I guess."
Ralph heard the snick of the bolt being turned as he eased Helen into the hard plastic contour chair behind the littery desk. He picked up the telephone and punched the button marked 911. Before the phone could ring on the other end, a blood-streaked hand reached out and pushed down the gray disconnect button.
"Door, Ralph,"
she swallowed with an obvious effort, and tried again.
"Don't!"
"Yes," Ralph said, "I'm going to." Now it was fear he saw in her one good eye. And nothing dull about it.
"No," she said. "Please, Ralph, don't."
She looked past him and held out her hands again. The humble, pleading look on her beaten face made Ralph wince with dismay.
"Ralph," Sue asked, "she wants the baby."
"I know. Go ahead." Sue handed Natalie to Helen, and Ralph watched as the baby, a little over a year old now, he was pretty sure, put her arms around her mother's neck and her face against her mother's shoulder. Helen kissed the top of Nat's head. It clearly hurt her to do this, but she did it again, and then again. Looking down at her, Ralph could see blood grimed into the faint creases on the nape of Helen's neck, like dirt. As he looked at this, he felt the anger begin to pulse again.
"It was Ed, wasn't it?" he asked.
"Of course it was. You didn't hit the cut-off button on the phone when someone tried to call 911 if you'd been beaten up by a total stranger." But he had to ask.
"Yes," she said.
Her voice was no more than a whisper, the answer a secret imparted into the fine cloud of her baby daughter's hair.
"Yes, it was Ed. But you can't call the police."
She looked up now, the good eye full of fear and misery.
"Please, don't call the police, Ralph. I can't bear to think of Natalie's dad in jail for...
Helen burst into tears. Natalie goggled at her mother for a moment in comic surprise, and then joined her. "Ralph," McGovern asked hesitantly, "do you want me to get her some Tylenol or something?"
"Better not," he said. "We don't know what's wrong with her, how bad she might be hurt."
His eyes shifted to the show window, not wanting to see what was out there, hoping not to, and seeing it anyway. Avid faces lined up all the way down to the place where the beer cooler cut off the view. Some of them were cupping their hands to the sides of their faces to cut the glare.
"What should we do, you guys?" Sue asked.
She was looking at the gawkers and picking nervously at the hem of the red apple duster employees had to wear.
"If the company finds out I locked the door during business hours, I'm apt to lose my job."
Helen tugged at his hand.
"Please, Ralph," she repeated. Only it came out, "Please, Ralph," through her swollen lips. "Don't call anybody."
Ralph looked at her uncertainly. He had seen a lot of women wearing a lot of bruises over the course of his life, and a couple, although not many in all honesty, who had been beaten much more severely than Helen. It hadn't always seemed this grim, though. His mind and morals had been formed at a time when people believed that what went on between a husband and wife behind the closed doors of their marriage was their business, and that included the man who hit with his fists and the woman who cut with her tongue. You couldn't make people behave, and meddling into their affairs, even with the best of intentions, all too often turned friends into enemies. But then he thought of the way she had been carrying Natalie as she staggered across the parking lot, held casually on one hip like a textbook. If she had dropped the baby in the parking lot or crossing Harris Avenue, she probably wouldn't have known it. Ralph guessed that it was nothing but instinct that had caused Helen to take the baby in the first place. She hadn't wanted to leave Matt in the care of the man who had beaten her so badly she could only see out of one eye and talk in mushy, rounded syllables. He thought of something else as well, something that had to do with the days following Carolyn's death earlier in the year. He'd been surprised at the depth of his grief. It had been an expected death, after all. He had believed he had taken care of most of his grieving while Carolyn was still alive, and it had rendered him awkward and ineffective about the final arrangements which needed to be made. He had managed the call to the Brookings Smith funeral home, but it was Helen who had gotten the obit form from the Derry News and helped him to fill it out. Helen, who had gone with him to pick out a coffin. McGovern, who hated death and the trappings which surrounded it, had made himself scarce. And Helen, who had helped him choose a floral centerpiece, the one which said, "Beloved wife." And it had been Helen, of course, who had orchestrated the little party afterward, providing sandwiches from Frank's catering and soft drinks and beer from the Red Apple. These were things Helen had done for him when he could not do them for himself. Did he not have an obligation to repay her kindness, even if Helen might not see it as kindness right now? "Bill," he asked, "what do you think?" McGovern looked from Ralph to Helen, sitting in the red plastic chair with her battered face lowered, and then back to Ralph again. He produced a handkerchief and wiped his lips nervously. "I don't know. I like Helen a lot, and I want to do the right thing. You know I do, but something like this, who knows what the right thing is?" Ralph suddenly remembered what Carolyn used to say whenever he started moaning and bitching about some chore he didn't want to do, some errand he didn't want to run, or some duty call he didn't want to make. "It's a long walk back to Eden, sweetheart, so don't sweat the small stuff." He reached for the phone again, and this time when Helen reached for his wrist, he pushed it away. "You've reached the Derry Police Department," a recorded voice told him. "Push 1 for emergency services. Push 2 for police services. Push 3 for information." Ralph, who suddenly understood he needed all 3, hesitated for a second and then pushed 2. The telephone buzzed and a woman's voice said, "This is police 911. How may I help you?" He took a deep breath and said, "This is Ralph Roberts. I'm at the Red Apple store on Harris Avenue with my neighbor from up the street. Her name is Helen Deepnow. She's been beaten up pretty badly." He put his hand gently on the side of Helen's face and she pressed her forehead against his side. He could feel the heat of her skin through his shirt. "Please, come as fast as you can." He hung the telephone up, then squatted down next to Helen. Natalie saw him, crowed with delight, and reached out to give his nose a friendly honk. Ralph smiled, kissed her tiny palm, then looked into Helen's face. "I'm sorry, Helen," he said, "but I had to. I couldn't not do it. Do you understand that? I couldn't not do it."
I don't understand anything," she said. Her nose had stopped bleeding, but when she reached up to swipe at it, she winced back from a touch of her own fingers.
"Helen, why did he do it? Why would Ed beat you up like this?" He found himself remembering other bruises, mostly on Helen's arms. A pattern of them, perhaps. If there had been a pattern, he had missed it until now. Because of Carolyn's death, and because of the insomnia which had come afterward. In any case, he did not believe this was the first time Ed had put his hands on his wife. Today might have been a drastic escalation, but it hadn't been the first time. He could grasp that idea and admit its logic, but he discovered he still couldn't see Ed doing it. He could see Ed's quick grin, his lively eyes, the way his hands moved restlessly when he talked, but he couldn't see Ed using those hands to beat the crap out of his wife, no matter how hard he tried. Then a memory resurfaced. A memory of Ed walking stiff-legged toward the man who had been driving the blue pickup. It had been a Ford Ranger, hadn't it? And then flicking the flat of his hand across the heavy-set man's jowls. Remembering that was like opening the door of Fibber McGee's closet in that old radio show. Only what came falling out wasn't an avalanche of old store junk, but a series of vivid images from that day last July. The Thunderheads building over the airport, Ed's arm popping out of the Datsun's window and waving up and down as if he could make the gate slide open faster that way. The scarf with the Chinese symbol on it. "Hey, hey, Susan Day, how many kids did you kill today?" Ralph thought, only it was Ed's voice he heard, and he pretty well knew what Helen was going to say before she even opened her mouth. "So stupid," she said dully. "He hit me because I signed a petition. That's all it was. They're circulating all over town. Someone pushed it into my face when I was going into the supermarket day before yesterday. He said something about a benefit for woman care, and that seemed all right. Besides, the baby was fussing, so I just..." "You just signed it," Ralph finished softly. She nodded and began to cry again. "What petition?" McGovern asked. "To bring Susan Day to Derry," Ralph told him. "She's a feminist..." "I know who Susan Day is," McGovern said irritably. "Anyway, a bunch of people are trying to get her here to speak on behalf of woman care."
"When Ed came home today, he was in a great mood," Helen said through her tears. "He almost always is on Thursdays, because it's his half day. He was talking about how he was going to spend the afternoon pretending to read a book, and actually just watching the sprinkler go around. You know how he is."
"Yes," Ralph said, remembering how Ed had plunged his arm into one of the heavy-set man's barrels. "And the crafty grin. I know a trick worth two of that. On his face. Yes, I know how he is."
"I sent him out to get some baby formula," her voice was rising, becoming fretful and frightened. "I didn't know he'd be upset. I'd all but forgotten about signing the damn thing, to tell the truth. And I still don't know exactly why he was so upset. But when he came back..."
She hugged Natalie to her, trembling. "Shh, Helen, take it easy. Everything's okay."
"No, it's not."
She looked up at him, tears streaming from one eye and seeping out from beneath the swelled lid of the other.
"It's not... no, not..."
"Why didn't he stop this time? And what's going to happen to me and the baby? Where will we go? I don't have any money except for what's in the joint checking account. I don't have a job."
"Oh, Ralph, why did you call the police? You shouldn't have done that."
And she hit his forearm with a strengthless little fist.
"You're going to get through this just fine," he said. "You've got a lot of friends in the neighborhood."
But he barely heard what he was saying and hadn't felt her small punch at all. The anger was thudding away in his chest and at his temples like a second heartbeat.
Not why didn't he stop? That wasn't what she had said. What she had said was, why didn't he stop this time? This time. "Helen, where's Ed now?"
"Home, I guess," she said dully.
Ralph patted her on the shoulder, then turned and started for the door.
"Ralph?"
Bill McGovern asked. He sounded alarmed.
"Where are you going?"
"Lock the door after me," Ralph told Sue.
"Geez, I don't know if I can do that."
Sue looked doubtfully at the line of gawkers peering in through the dirty window. There were more of them now.
"You can," he said, then cocked his head, catching the first faint wail of an approaching siren.
"Hear that?"
"Yes, but the cops will tell you what to do, and your boss won't be mad at you either. He'll probably give you a medal for handling everything just right."
"If he does, I'll split it with you," she said, then glanced at Helen again. A little color had come back into Sue's cheeks, but not much. Jeepers, Ralph, look at her. Did he really beat her up because she signed some stupid paper in Shaw's?
"I guess so," Ralph said.
The conversation made perfect sense to him, but it was coming in long distance. His rage was closer. It had its hot arms locked around his neck, it seemed. He wished he were 40 again, even 50, so he could give Ed a taste of his own medicine. And he had an idea he might try doing that anyway. He was turning the thumb bolt of the door when McGovern grabbed his shoulder.
"What do you think you're doing?"
"Going to see Ed."
"Are you kidding? He'll take you apart if you get in his face. Didn't you see what he did to her?"
"You bet I did," Ralph replied. The words weren't quite a snarl, but close enough to make McGovern drop his hand.
"You're 70 fucking years old, Ralph, in case you forgot. And Helen needs a friend right now, not some busted-up antique she can visit because his hospital room is 3 doors down from hers."
Bill was right, of course, but that only made Ralph angrier. He supposed the insomnia was at work in this, too, stoking his anger and blurring his judgment. But that made no difference. In a way, the anger was a relief. It was better, certainly, than drifting through a world where everything had turned shades of dark gray. "If he beats me up bad enough, they'll give me some Demerol and I can get a decent night's sleep," he said. "Now leave me alone, Bill." He crossed the Red Apple parking lot at a brisk walk.
A police car was approaching with its blue grill flashes pulsing. Questions. What happened? She okay? Were thrown at him, but Ralph ignored them. He paused on the sidewalk, waited for the police car to swing into the parking lot, then crossed Harris Avenue at that same brisk walk with McGovern trailing anxiously after him at a prudent distance. Ed and Helen Deepnow lived in a small Cape Cod, chocolate brown, whipped cream trim, the kind of house which older women often call darling, four houses up from the one Ralph and Bill McGovern shared. Carolyn had liked to say the Deepnows belonged to the Church of the Latter-day Yuppies, although her genuine liking for them had robbed the phrase of any real bite. They were laissez-faire vegetarians who considered both fish and dairy products okay. They'd worked for Clinton in the last election. And the car in the driveway, not a Datsun now, but one of the new minivans, was wearing bumper stickers which said, "Split wood, not atoms," and "Fur on animals, not people." The Deepnows had also apparently kept every album they had ever purchased during the 60s. Carolyn had found this one of their most endearing characteristics. And now, as Ralph approached the Cape Cod with his hands curled into fists at his sides, he heard Grace Slick wailing one of those old San Francisco anthems. "One pill makes you bigger, one pill makes you small, and the ones that Mother gives you don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall." The music was coming from a boombox on the Cape Cod's postage-stamp-sized porch. A sprinkler twirled on the lawn, making a shh, shh, shh sound as it cast rainbows in the air, and deposited a shiny wet patch on the sidewalk. Ed Deepnow, shirtless, was sitting in a lawn chair to the left of the concrete walk with his legs crossed, looking up at the sky with the bemused expression of a man trying to decide if the cloud passing overhead looks more like a horse or a unicorn. One barefoot bopped up and down in time to the music. The book lying open and face down in his lap went perfectly with the music pouring from the boombox. "Even Cowgirls Get the Blues," by Tom Robbins. An all-but-perfect summer vignette, a scene of small-town serenity Norman Rockwell might have painted and then titled "Afternoon Off." All you had to overlook was the blood on Ed's knuckles and the drop on the left lens of his round John Lennon specs. "Ralph, for God's sake, don't get into a fight with him," McGovern hissed as Ralph left the sidewalk and cut across the lawn. He walked through the lawn sprinkler's fine cold spray almost without feeling it. Ed turned, saw him, and broke into a sunny grin. "Hey, Ralph," he said. "Good to see you, man." In his mind's eye, Ralph saw himself reaching out and shoving Ed's chair, pushing him over and spilling him onto his lawn. He saw Ed's eyes widen with shock and surprise behind the lenses of his glasses. This vision was so real, he even saw the way the sun reflected on the face of Ed's watch as he tried to sit up. "Grab yourself a beer and drag up a rock," Ed was saying, "if you feel like a game of chess." "Beer? A game of chess? Christ Jesus, Ed, what's wrong with you?" Ed didn't answer immediately, only looked at Ralph with an expression that was both frightening and infuriating. It was a mixture of amusement and shame. The look of a man who's getting ready to say, "Ah, shit, honey, did I forget to put out the trash again?" Ralph pointed down the hill, past McGovern, who was standing. He would have been lurking if there'd been something to lurk behind, near the wet patch the sprinkler had put on the sidewalk, watching them nervously. The first police car had been joined by a second, and Ralph could faintly hear the crackle of radio calls through the open windows. The crowd had gotten quite a bit bigger. "The police are there because of Helen," he said, telling himself not to shout. It would do no good to shout, and shouting anyway. "They're there because you beat up your wife. Is that getting through to you?" "Oh," Ed said, and rubbed his cheek ruefully. "That?" "Yes, that," Ralph said. He now felt almost stupefied with rage. Ed peered past him at the police cars, at the crowd standing around the Red Apple, and then he saw McGovern. "Bill," he cried. McGovern recoiled. Ed either didn't notice or pretended not to. "Hey, man, drag up a rock. Want a beer?" That was when Ralph knew he was going to hit Ed. break his stupid little round-lensed spectacles, drive a splinter of glass into his eye, maybe. He was going to do it. Nothing on earth could stop him from doing it. Except, at the last moment, something did. It was Carolyn's voice he heard inside his head most frequently these days. When he wasn't just muttering along to himself, that was. But this wasn't Carolyn's voice. This one, as unlikely as it seemed, belonged to Trigger Vashon, whom he'd only seen once or twice since the day Trigger had saved him from the thunderstorm, the day Carolyn had had her first seizure.
"Aye, Ralph, be damn careful, you. This one crazy like a fox. Maybe he want you to hit him."
Yes, he decided. Maybe that was just what Ed wanted. Why? Who knew? Maybe to muddy the waters up a little bit. Maybe just because he was crazy. "Cut the shit," he said, dropping his voice almost to a whisper. He was gratified to see Ed's attention snap back to him in a hurry, and even more pleased to see Ed's pleasantly vague expression of rueful amusement disappear. It was replaced by a narrow, watchful expression. It was, Ralph thought, the look of a dangerous animal with its wind up. Ralph hunkered down so he could look directly at Ed. "Was it Susan Day?" he asked in the same soft voice. "Susan Day and the abortion business? Something about dead babies? Is that why you unloaded on Helen?" There was another question on his mind. "Who are you, really, Ed?" But before he could ask it, Ed reached out, placed a hand in the center of Ralph's chest, and pushed. Ralph fell backward onto the damp grass, catching himself on his elbows and shoulders. He lay there with his feet flat on the ground and his knees up, watching as Ed suddenly sprang out of his lawn chair. "Ralph, don't mess with him," McGovern called from his place of relative safety on the sidewalk. Ralph paid no attention. He simply remained where he was, propped on his elbows and looking attentively up at Ed. He was still angry and afraid, but these emotions had begun to be overshadowed by a strange, chilly fascination. This was madness he was looking at. The genuine article. No comic book supervillain here. No Norman Bates. No Captain Ahab. It was just Ed Deepnow who worked down the coast at Hawking Labs. "One of those eggheads," the old guys who played chess at the picnic area out on the extension would have said. "But still a nice enough fella for a Democrat." Now the nice enough fella had gone mad, totally bonkers, and it hadn't just happened this afternoon when Ed had seen his wife's name on a petition hanging from the community bulletin board in Shores. Ralph now understood that Ed's madness was at least a year old, and that made him wonder what secrets Helen had been keeping behind her normal, cheery demeanor and sunny smile, and what small, desperate signals, beside the bruises, that was, he might have missed. And then there's Natalie, he thought. What's she seen? What's she experienced? Besides, of course, being carried across Harris Avenue and the Red Apple parking lot on her staggering, bleeding mother's hip. Ralph's arms broke out in goosebumps. Ed had begun to pace, meanwhile, crossing and recrossing the cement path, trampling the zinnias Helen had planted along it as a border. He had returned to the Ed Ralph had encountered out by the airport the year before, right down to the fierce little pokes of the head and the sharp, jabbing glances at nothing. This is what the gee-whiz act was supposed to hide, Ralph thought. He looks the same now as he did when he took after the guy driving that pickup truck. Like a rooster protecting his little piece of the barnyard. "None of this is strictly her fault, I admit that," Ed spoke rapidly, pounding his right fist into his open left palm as he walked through the cloud of spray thrown by the sprinkler. Ralph realized he could see every rib in Ed's chest. The man looked as if he hadn't had a decent meal in months. "Still, once stupidity reaches a certain level, it becomes hard to live with," Ed went on. "She's like the Magi, actually coming to King Herod for information. I mean, how dumb can you get? Where is he that is born king of the Jews? To Herod they say this. I mean, wise men my ass. Right, Ralph?" Ralph nodded. "Sure, Ed. Whatever you say, Ed." Ed returned the nod and went on tramping back and forth through the spray and the ghostly interlocking rainbows, smacking his fist into his palm. "It's like that Rolling Stones song. Look at that! Look at that! Look at that stupid girl!" "You probably don't remember that one, do you?" Ed laughed, a jagged little sound that made Ralph think of rats dancing on broken glass.
McGovern knelt beside him. "Let's get out of here," he muttered. Ralph shook his head, and when Ed swung back in their direction, McGovern quickly got up and retreated to the sidewalk again. "She thought she could fool you, is that it?" Ralph asked. He was still lying on the lawn, propped up on his elbows. "She thought you wouldn't find out she signed the petition." Ed leaped over the walk, bent over Ralph, and shook his clenched fists over his head like the bad guy in a silent movie. "No, no, no, no," he cried. The Jefferson airplane had been replaced by the animals, Eric Burden growling out the gospel according to John Lee Hooker. "Boom, boom, boom, boom. Gonna shoot you right down." McGovern uttered a thin cry, apparently thinking Ed meant to attack Ralph. But instead, Ed sank down with the knuckles of his left hand pressed into the grass, assuming the position of a sprinter who waits for the starter's gun to explode him out of the blocks. His face was covered with beads of what Ralph at first took for sweat before remembering the way Ed had paced back and forth through the spray from the sprinkler. Ralph kept looking at the spot of blood on the left lens of Ed's glasses. It had smeared a little, and now the pupil of his left eye looked as if it had filled up with blood. "Finding out that she signed the petition was fate. Simple fate. Do you mean to tell me you don't see that? Don't insult my intelligence, Ralph. You may be getting on in years, but you're far from stupid. The thing is, I go down to the supermarket to buy Simulac. Baby formula. How's that for irony? And find out she signed on with the baby killers. The Centurions. Or the Crimson King himself. And you know what? I just saw red. The Crimson King, Ed? Who's he?" "Oh, please." Ed gave Ralph a cunning look. "Then Herod, when he saw that he was mocked, was exceeding wroth, and sent forth and slew all the children that were in Bethlehem, and in all the coasts thereof, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had diligently inquired of the wise men." "It's in the Bible, Ralph, in good King James, Matthew, chapter 2, verse 16. Do you doubt it? Do you have any fucking question that it says that?" "No, if you say so, I believe it." Ed nodded, his eyes a deep and startling shade of green, dotted here and there. Then he slowly leaned forward over Ralph, planting one hand on either side of Ralph's arms. It was as if he meant to kiss him. Ralph could smell sweat and some sort of aftershave that had almost completely faded away now, and something else. Something that smelled like old curdled milk. He wondered if it might be the smell of Ed's madness. An ambulance was coming up Harris Avenue, running its flashes but not its siren. It turned into the Red Apple's parking lot. "You better," Ed breathed into his face. "You just better believe it." His eyes stopped wandering and centered on Ralph's. "They are killing the babies wholesale," he said in a low voice, which was not quite steady, "ripping them from the wombs of their mothers and carrying them out of town in covered trucks. Flatbeds for the most part. Ask yourself this, Ralph. How many times a week do you see one of those big flatbeds tooling down the road? A flatbed with a tarp stretched over the back. Ever ask yourself what those trucks were carrying? Ever wonder what was under most of those tarps?" Ed grinned. His eyes rolled. "They burn most of the fetuses over in Newport. The sign says landfill, but it's really a crematorium. They send some of them out of state, though, in trucks, in light planes, because fetal tissue is extremely valuable. I tell you that not just as a concerned citizen, Ralph, but as an employee of Hawking Laboratories. Fetal tissue is more valuable than gold." He turned his head suddenly and stared at Bill McGovern, who had crept a little closer again in order to hear what Ed was saying. "Yea, more valuable than gold and more precious than rubies," he screamed. And McGovern leaped back, eyes widening in fear and dismay. "Do you know that, you old faggot?" "Yes," McGovern said. I guess I did." He shot a quick glance down the street where one of the police cars was now backing out of the Red Apple lot and turning in that direction. "I might have read it somewhere. In Scientific American, perhaps." "Scientific American?" Ed laughed with gentle contempt and rolled his eyes at Ralph again, as if to say, "You see what I have to deal with?" Then his face grew sober again.
Wholesale murder, he said. Just as in the time of Christ. Only now it's the murder of the unborn. Not just here, but all over the world. They've been slaughtering them by their thousands, Ralph. By their millions. And do you know why? Do you know why we've re-entered the court of the Crimson King in this new age of darkness? Ralph knew. It wasn't that hard to put together if you had enough pieces to work with. If you had seen Ed with his arm buried in a barrel of chemical fertilizer, fishing around for the dead babies he'd been sure he would find. King Herod got a little advance word this time around, Ralph said. That's what you're telling me, isn't it? It's the old Messiah thing, right? He sat up, half expecting Ed to shove him down again, almost hoping he would. His anger was coming back. It was surely wrong to critique a madman's delusional fantasies the way he might a play or a movie, maybe even blasphemous. But Ralph found the idea that Helen had been beaten because of such hackneyed old shit as this infuriating. Ed didn't touch him, merely got to his feet and dusted his hands off in businesslike fashion. He seemed to be cooling down again. Radio calls crackled louder as the police cruiser, which had backed out of the Red Apples lot, now glided up to the curb. Ed looked at the cruiser, then back at Ralph, who was getting up himself. You can mock, but it's true, he said quietly. It's not King Herod, though. It's the Crimson King. Herod was merely one of his incarnations. The Crimson King jumps from body to body and generation to generation, like a kid using stepping stones to cross a brook, Ralph. Always looking for the Messiah. He's always missed him, but this time it could be different. Because Derry's different. All lines of force have begun to converge here. I know how difficult that is to believe, but it's true. The Crimson King, Ralph thought. Oh, Helen, I'm so sorry. What a sad thing this is. Two men, one in uniform, one in street clothes, both presumably cops, got out of the police car and approached McGovern. Behind them, down at the store, Ralph spotted two more men, these dressed in white pants and white short-sleeved shirts, coming out of the Red Apple. One had his arm around Helen, who was walking with the fragile care of a post-op patient. The other was holding Natalie. These two men, Ralph supposed they were paramedics, helped Helen into the back of the ambulance. The one with the baby got in after her while the other moved toward the driver's seat. What Ralph sensed in their movements was competency rather than urgency, and he thought that was good news for Helen. Maybe Ed hadn't hurt her too badly. This time, at least. The plainclothes cop, burly, broad-shouldered, and wearing his blonde mustache and sideburns in a style Ralph thought of as early American singles bar, had approached McGovern, whom he seemed to recognize. There was a big grin on the plainclothes cop's face. Ed put an arm over Ralph's shoulders and pulled him a few steps away from the men on the sidewalk. He also dropped his voice to a bare murmur. I don't want them to hear us, he said. Well, I'm sure you don't. These creatures, centurions, servants of the Crimson King, will stop at nothing. They are relentless. I'll bet. Ralph glanced over his shoulder in time to see McGovern pointed at Ed. The burly man nodded calmly. His hands were stuffed in the pockets of his chinos. He was still wearing a small, benign smile. This isn't just about abortion. Don't get that idea. Not anymore. They're taking the unborn from all kinds of mothers, not just the junkies and the whores. 8 days, 8 weeks, 8 months. It's all the same to the centurions. The harvest goes on day and night. The slaughter. I've seen the corpses of infants on roofs, Ralph, under hedges. They're in the sewers, floating in the sewers. And in the Kenderskeeg down in the barrens. His eyes, huge and green, as bright as trumpery emeralds, stared off into the distance. Ralph, he whispered, sometimes the world is full of colors. I've seen them since he came and told me. But now all the colors are turning black. Since who came and told you, Ed? We'll talk about it later, Ed replied, speaking out of the corner of his mouth like a con in a prison movie. Under other circumstances, it would have been funny. A big game show host grin dawned on his face, banishing the madness as convincingly as sunrise banishes night. The change was almost tropical in its suddenness, and creepy as hell, but Ralph found something comforting about it, just the same. Perhaps he, McGovern, Lois, all the others on this little stretch of Harris Avenue who knew Ed, would not have to blame themselves too much for not seeing his madness sooner, after all. Because Ed was good. Ed really had his act down. That grin was an Academy Award winner. Even in a bizarre situation like this, it practically demanded that you respond to it. "Hey, hi," he told the two cops. The burly one had finished his conversation with McGovern, and both of them were advancing across the lawn. "Drag up a rock, you guys." Ed stepped around Ralph with his hand held out. The burly plainclothes cop shook it, still smiling a small, benign smile. "Edward Deepnow?" he asked. "Right." Ed shook hands with the uniformed cop, who looked a trifle bemused, and then returned his attention to the burly man. "I'm Detective Sergeant John Laydecker," the burly man said. "This is Officer Chris Nell. Understand you had a little trouble here, sir." "Well, yes, I guess that's right. A little trouble. Or if you want to call a spade, I behaved like a horse's ass." Ed's embarrassed little chuckle was alarmingly normal. Ralph thought of all the charming psychopaths he'd seen in the movies. George Sanders had always been particularly good at that sort of role, and wondered if it was possible for a smart research chemist to snow a small city detective who looked as if he had never completely outgrown his Saturday Night Fever phase. Ralph was terribly afraid it might be. "Helen and I got into an argument about a petition she'd signed," Ed was saying, "and one thing just led to another. Man, I just can't believe I hit her." He flapped his arms as if to convey how flustered he was, not to mention confused and ashamed. Laydecker smiled in return. Ralph's mind returned to the confrontation last summer between Ed and the man in the blue pickup. Ed had called the heavy-set man a murderer, had even stroked him one across the face. And still the guy had ended up looking at Ed almost with respect. It had been like a kind of hypnosis, and Ralph thought he was seeing the same force at work here. "Things just kind of got out of hand a little, is that what you're telling me?" Laydecker asked sympathetically. "Well, that's about the size of it, yeah." Ed had to be at least 35, but his wide eyes and innocent expression made him look barely old enough to buy beer. "Wait a minute," Ralph blurted. "You can't believe him. He's nuts and dangerous. He just told me..." "This is Mr. Roberts, right?" Laydecker asked McGovern, ignoring Ralph completely. "Yes," McGovern said, and to Ralph he sounded insufferably pompous. "That is Ralph Roberts." "Uh-huh." Laydecker at last looked at Ralph. "I'll want to speak to you in a couple of minutes, Mr. Roberts, but for the time being I'd like you to stand over there beside your friend and keep quiet, okay?" "But, okay?" Angrier than ever, Ralph stalked over to where McGovern was standing. This did not seem to upset Laydecker in the least. He turned to Officer Nell. "You want to turn off the music, Chris, so we can hear ourselves think?" "Yo!" The uniformed cop went to the boombox, inspected the various knobs and switches, then killed the Who halfway through the song about the blind pinball wizard. "I guess I did have it cranked a little," Ed looked sheepish. "Wonder the neighbors didn't complain." "Oh, well, life goes on," Laydecker said. He tilted his small, serene smile up toward the clouds drifting across the blue summer sky. "Wonderful," Ralph thought. "This guy is a regular Will Rogers." Ed, however, was nodding as if the detective had produced not just a single pearl of wisdom, but a whole string of them. Laydecker rummaged in his pocket and came out with a little tube of toothpicks. He offered them to Ed, who declined, then shook one out and stuck it in the corner of his mouth. "So," he said, "little family argument, is that what I'm hearing?" Ed nodded eagerly. He was still smiling his sincere, slightly puzzled smile. "More of a discussion, actually, a political..."
Uh-huh,
Laydecker said, nodding and smiling. "But before you go any further, Mr. Deepnow, Ed, please. Before we go any further, Mr. Deepnow, I just kind of want to tell you that anything you say could be used against you, you know, in a court of law. Also that you have a right to an attorney." Ed's friendly but puzzled smile, "Gosh, what did I do? Can you help me figure it out?" faltered for a moment. The narrow, appraising look replaced it. Ralph glanced at McGovern, and the relief he saw in Bill's eyes mirrored what he was feeling himself. Lydecker was maybe not such a hick after all.
"What in God's name would I want an attorney for?" Ed asked. He made a half-turn and tried the puzzled smile out on Chris Nell, who was still standing beside the boombox on the porch steps.
"I don't know, and maybe you don't," Lydecker said, still smiling. "I'm just telling you that you can have one, and that if you can't afford one, the city of Derry will provide you with one."
"But I don't..."
Lydecker was nodding and smiling. "That's okay, sure, whatever. But those are your rights. Do you understand your rights as I've explained them to you, Mr. Deepnow?"
Ed stood stock still for a moment, his eyes suddenly wide and blank again. To Ralph, he looked like a human computer trying to process a huge and complicated wad of input. Then the fact that the snow job wasn't working seemed to get through to him. His shoulders sagged. The blankness was replaced by a look of unhappiness too real to doubt. But Ralph doubted it anyway. He had to doubt it. He'd seen the madness on Ed's face before Lydecker and Nell arrived. So had Bill McGovern. Yet doubt was not quite the same as disbelief. And Ralph had an idea that on some level, Ed honestly regretted beating Helen up.
"Yes," he thought, "just as on some level he honestly believes that these centurions of his are driving truckloads of fetuses out to the Newport landfill, and that the forces of good and evil are gathering in Derry to play out some drama that's going on in his mind. Call it Omen 5, in the court of the Crimson King."
Still, he could not help feeling a reluctant sympathy for Ed Deepnow, who had visited Carolyn faithfully 3 times a week during her final confinement at Derry Home, who always brought flowers and always kissed her on the cheek when he left. He had continued giving her that kiss even when the smell of death had begun to surround her, and Carolyn had never failed to clasp his hand and give him a smile of gratitude. "Thank you for remembering that I'm still a human being," that smile had said. "And thank you for treating me like one." That was the Ed Ralph had thought of as his friend, and he thought, or maybe only hoped, that that Ed was still in there.
"I'm in trouble here, aren't I?" he asked Lydecker softly.
"Well, let's see," Lydecker said, still smiling. "You knocked out 2 of your wife's teeth. Looks like you fractured her cheekbone. I bet you my grandfather's watch she's got a concussion. Plus selected short subjects, cuts, bruises, and this funny bare patch over her right temple. What'd you try to do, snatch her bald-headed?"
Ed was silent, his green eyes fixed on Lydecker's face.
"She's going to spend the night in the hospital under observation because some asshole pounded the hell out of her, and everybody seems in agreement that the asshole was you, Mr. Deepnow. I look at the blood on your hands and the blood on your glasses, and I gotta say, I also think it was probably you. So what do you think? You look like a bright guy. Do you think you're in trouble?"
"I'm very sorry I hit her," Ed said. "I didn't mean to."
"Uh-huh. And if I had a quarter for every time I've heard that, I'd never have to buy another drink out of my paycheck. I'm arresting you on a charge of second-degree assault, Mr. Deepnow, also known as domestic assault. This charge falls under Maine's domestic violence law. I'd like you to confirm once more that I've informed you of your rights."
"Yes," Ed spoke in a small, unhappy voice. The smile, puzzled or otherwise, was gone.
"We're going to take you down to the police station and book you," Lydecker said. "Following that, you can make a telephone call and arrange bail. Chris, put him in the car, would you?"
Nell approached Ed.
"Are you going to be a problem, Mr. Deepnow?"
"No," Ed said in that same small voice, and Ralph saw a tear slip from Ed's right eye. He wiped it away absently with the heel of his hand.
"No problem."
"Great," Nell said heartily, and walked with him to the cruiser. Ed glanced at Ralph as he crossed the sidewalk.
"I'm sorry, old boy," he said, then got into the back of the car. Before Officer Nell closed the door, Ralph saw there was no handle on the inside of it.
"Okay," Lydecker said, turning to Ralph and holding out his hand. "I'm sorry if I seemed a little brisk, Mr. Roberts.
But sometimes these guys can be volatile. I especially worry about the ones who look sober, because you can never tell what they'll do. John Lydecker. I had Johnny as a student when I was teaching at the community college, McGovern said. Now that Ed Deepnow was safely tucked away in the back of the cruiser, he sounded almost giddy with relief. Good student. Did an excellent term paper on the Children's Crusade. It's a pleasure to meet you, Ralph said, shaking Lydecker's hand. And don't worry, no offense taken. You were insane to come up here and confront him, you know, Lydecker said cheerfully. I was pissed off. I'm still pissed off. I can understand that, but you got away with it. That's the important thing. No, Helen's the important thing. Helen and the baby. I can go with that. Tell me what you and Mr. Deepnow talked about before we got up here, Mr. Roberts. Or can I call you Ralph? Ralph, please. He ran through his conversation with Ed, trying to keep it brief. McGovern, who had heard some of it, but not all of it, listened in round-eyed silence. Every time Ralph looked at him, he found himself wishing Bill had worn his Panama. He looked older without it, almost ancient. Well, that certainly sounds pretty weird, doesn't it? Lydecker remarked when Ralph had finished. What will happen? Will he go to jail? He shouldn't go to jail. He should be committed. Probably should be, Lydecker agreed. But there's a lot of distance between should be and will be. He won't go to jail, and he isn't going to be carted off to Sunnyvale Sanitarium either. That sort of thing only happens in old movies. The best we can hope for is some court-ordered therapy. But didn't Helen tell you... The lady didn't tell us anything, and we didn't try to question her in the store. She was in a lot of pain, both physical and emotional. Yes, of course she was, Ralph said. Stupid of me. She might corroborate your stuff later on, but she might not. Domestic abuse victims have a way of turning into clams, you know. Luckily, it doesn't really matter one way or the other under the new law. We got him nailed to the wall. You and the lady in the little store down the street can testify to Mrs. Deepnow's condition and to who she said put her in that condition. I can testify to the fact that the victim's husband had blood on his hands. Best of all, he said the magic words, "Man, I just can't believe I hit her." I'm going to come over probably tomorrow morning, if that works for you, and take a complete statement from you, Ralph. But that's just filling in the blanks. Basically, this one's a done deal. Lydecker took the toothpick out of his mouth, broke it, tossed it in the gutter, and produced his tube again. Pick? No thanks, Ralph said, smiling faintly. Don't blame you. A lousy habit. But I'm trying to quit smoking, which is an even worse one. The thing about guys like Deepnow is that they're too goddamn smart for their own good. They go over the high side, hurt someone, and then they pull back. If you get there soon enough after the blow-up, like you did, Ralph, you can almost see them standing there with their heads cocked, listening to the music, and trying to get back on the beat. That's just how it was, Ralph said. Exactly how it was. It's a trick the bright ones manage for quite a while. They appear remorseful, appalled by their own actions, determined to make amends. They're persuasive, they're charming, and it's often all but impossible to see that underneath the sugar coating they're as nutty as Christmas fruitcakes. Even extreme cases like Ted Bundy sometimes manage to look normal for years. The good news is that there aren't many guys like Ted Bundy out there, in spite of all the psycho killer books and movies. Ralph sighed deeply. What a mess. Yeah, but look on the bright side, Ralph. We're going to be able to keep him away from her, at least for a while. He'll be out by supper time on $25 bail, but $25? McGovern asked. He sounded simultaneously shocked and cynical. That's all? Yep, Lydecker said. I gave Deepnow the second-degree assault stuff because it do sound fearsome. But in the state of Maine, lumping up your wife is only a misdemeanor. Still, there's a nifty new wrinkle in the law, Chrisnell said, joining them. If Deepnow wants bail, he has to agree that he'll have absolutely no contact with his wife until the case is settled in court. He can't come to the house, approach her on the street, or even call her on the phone. If he doesn't agree, he sits in jail. Suppose he agrees and then comes back anyway, Ralph asked.
Then we slam dunk 'em, Nell said, because that one is a felony, or can be, if the district attorney wants to play hardball. In any case, violators of the domestic violence bail agreement usually spend a lot more than just the afternoon in jail. And hopefully the spouse he breaks the agreement to visit will still be alive when he comes to trial, McGovern said. Yeah, Lydecker said heavily. Sometimes that's a problem. Ralph went home and sat staring not at the TV, but through it for an hour or so. He got up during a commercial to see if there was a cold Coke in the refrigerator, staggered on his feet, and had to put a hand on the wall to steady himself. He was trembling all over and felt unpleasantly close to vomiting. He understood that this was nothing but delayed reaction, but the weakness and nausea still frightened him. He sat down again, took a minute's worth of deep breaths with his head down and his eyes closed, then got up and walked slowly into the bathroom. He filled the tub with warm water and soaked until he heard Night Court, the first of the afternoon sitcoms, starting up on the TV in the living room. By then, the water in the tub had become almost chilly, and Ralph was glad to get out. He dried off, dressed in fresh clothes, and decided that a light supper was at least in the realm of possibility. He called downstairs, thinking McGovern might like to join him for a bite to eat, but there was no answer. Ralph put on water in which to boil a couple of eggs and called Derry Home Hospital from the phone by the stove. His call was shunted to a woman in patient services who checked a computer and told him, yes, he was correct, Helen Deepnoe had been admitted to the hospital. Her condition was listed as fair. No, she had no idea who was taking care of Mrs. Deepnoe's baby. All she knew was that she did not have a Natalie Deepnoe on her admissions list. No, Ralph could not visit Mrs. Deepnoe that evening, but not because her doctor had established a no-visitors policy. Mrs. Deepnoe had left that order herself. Why would she do that? Ralph started to ask, then didn't bother. The woman in patient services would probably tell him she was sorry. She didn't have that information in her computer. But Ralph decided he had it in his computer, the one between his giant economy-size ears. Helen didn't want visitors because she was ashamed. None of what had happened was her fault, but Ralph doubted if that changed the way she felt. She had been seen by half of Harris Avenue, staggering around like a badly beaten boxer after the ref had stopped the fight. She had been taken to the hospital in an ambulance, and her husband, the father of her daughter, was responsible. Ralph hoped they would give her something that would help her sleep through the night. He had an idea things might look a little better to her in the morning. God knew they couldn't look much worse. Hell, I wish someone would give me something to help me sleep through the night, he thought. Then go see Dr. Litchfield, you idiot, another part of his mind responded immediately. The woman in patient services was asking Ralph if she could do anything else for him. Ralph said no and was starting to thank her when the line clicked in his ear. Nice, Ralph said, very nice. He hung up himself, got a tablespoon, and gently lowered his eggs into the water. 10 minutes later, as he was sitting down with the boiled eggs sliding around on a plate and looking like the world's biggest pearls, the phone rang. He put his supper on the table and grabbed it off the wall. Hello? Silence, broken only by breathing. Hello? Ralph repeated. There was one more breath, this one almost loud enough to be an aspirated sob, and then another click in his ear. Ralph hung the telephone up and stood looking at it for a moment, his frown putting three ascending wave lines on his brow. Come on, Helen, he said. Call me back, please. Then he returned to the table, sat down, and began to eat his small bachelor's supper. He was washing up his few dishes 15 minutes later when the phone rang again. That won't be her, he thought, wiping his hands on a dish towel and then flipping it over his shoulder as he went to the phone. No way it'll be her. It's probably Lois or Bill. But another part of him knew differently. Hi, Ralph. Hello, Helen. That was me a few minutes ago. Her voice was husky as if she'd been drinking or crying, and Ralph didn't think they allowed booze in the hospital. I kind of figured that. I heard your voice, and I couldn't... That's okay. I understand. Do you? She gave a long, watery sniff. I think so, yes. The nurse came by and gave me a pain pill. I can use it, too. My face really hurts. But I wouldn't let myself take it until I called you again and said what I had to say. Pain sucks, but it's a hell of an incentive. Helen, you don't have to say anything. But he was afraid that she did, and he was afraid of what it might be. Afraid of finding out that she had decided to be angry at him because she couldn't be angry with Ed.
Yes, I do. I have to say, thank you.
Ralph leaned against the side of the door and closed his eyes for a moment. He was relieved but unsure how to reply. He'd been ready to say, I'm sorry you feel that way, Helen, in the calmest voice he could manage. That was how sure he'd been that she was going to start off by asking him why he couldn't mind his own business. And, as if she had read his mind and wanted to let him know he wasn't entirely off the hook, Helen said,
I spent most of the ride here and the check-in and the first hour or so in the room being terribly angry at you. I called Candy Shoemaker, my friend from over on Kansas Street, and she came and got Matt. She's keeping her for the night. She wanted to know what had happened, but I wouldn't tell her. I just wanted to lie here and be mad that you called 911, even though I told you not to. Helen, let me finish so I can take my pill and go to sleep, okay?
Okay. Just after Candy left with the baby, Nat didn't cry, thank God. I don't know if I could have handled that. A woman came in. At first I thought she must have gotten the wrong room because I didn't know her from Eve. And when I got it through my head that she was here to see me, I told her I didn't want any visitors. She didn't pay any attention. She closed the door and lifted her skirt up so I could see her left thigh. There was a deep scar running down it, almost all the way from her hip to her knee. She said her name was Gretchen Tilbury, that she was a family abuse counselor at Woman Care, and that her husband had cut her leg open with a kitchen knife in 1978. She said if the man in the downstairs apartment hadn't gotten a tourniquet on it, she would have bled to death. I said I was very sorry to hear that, but I didn't want to talk about my own situation until I'd had a chance to think it over. Helen paused and then said, But that was a lie, you know. I've had plenty of time to think it over, because Ed first hit me 2 years ago, long before I got pregnant with Nat. I just kept pushing it away.
I can see how a person would do that, Ralph said.
This lady, well, they must give people like her lessons on how to get through people's defenses.
Ralph smiled.
I believe that's about half their training. She said I couldn't put it off, that I had a bad situation on my hands, and I had to start dealing with it right away. I said that whatever I didn't have to consult her before I did it, or listen to her line of bullshit, just because her husband had cut her once. I almost said he probably did it because she wouldn't shut up and go away and give him some peace. Can you believe that? But I was really pissed, Ralph. Hurting, confused, ashamed, but mostly just PO'd.
I think that's probably a pretty normal reaction.
She asked me how I'd feel about myself. Not about Ed, but about myself, if I went back into the relationship and Ed beat me up again. Then she asked how I'd feel if I went back in and Ed did it to Nat. That made me furious. It still makes me furious. Ed had never laid so much as a finger on her, and I said so. She nodded and said, That doesn't mean he won't, Helen. I know you don't want to think about that, but you have to. Still, suppose you're right. Suppose he never so much as slaps her on the wrist. Do you want her to grow up watching him hit you? Do you want her to grow up seeing the things she saw today? And that stopped me cold. I remembered how Ed looked when he came back in, how I knew as soon as I saw how white his face was, the way his head was moving, like a rooster, Ralph muttered. What? Nothing. Go on. I don't know what set him off. I never do anymore. But I knew he was going to start in on me. There's nothing you can do or say to stop it once he gets to a certain point. I ran for the bedroom, but he grabbed me by the hair. He pulled out a great big bunch of it. I screamed, and Natalie was sitting there in a high chair, sitting there watching us. And when I screamed, she screamed. Helen broke down then, crying hard.
Ralph waited with his forehead leaning against the side of the doorway between the kitchen and the living room. He used the end of the dish towel he'd slung over his shoulder to wipe away his own tears, almost without thinking about it. "Anyway," Helen said when she was capable of speaking again, "I ended up talking to this woman for almost an hour. It's called victim counseling, and she does it for a living. Can you believe it?" "Yes," Ralph said, "I can." "It's a good thing, Helen." "I'm going to see her again tomorrow at Woman Care. It's ironic, you know, that I should be going there. I mean, if I hadn't signed that petition..." "If it hadn't been the petition, it would have been something else." She sighed. "Yes, I guess that might be true. Is true. Anyway, Gretchen says I can't solve Ed's problems, but I can start solving some of my own." Helen started to cry again, and then took a deep breath. "I'm sorry. I've cried so much today, I never want to cry again." "I told her I loved him. I felt ashamed to say it, and I'm not even sure it's true, but it feels true. I said I wanted to give him another chance. She said that meant I was committing Natalie to give him another chance, too. And that made me think of how she looked sitting there in the kitchen, with pureed spinach all over her face, screaming her head off while Ed hit me. God, I hate the way people like her drive you into a corner and won't let you out. She's trying to help, that's all. I hate that, too. I'm very confused, Ralph. Probably you didn't know that, but I am." A wan chuckle drifted down the telephone line. "That's okay, Helen. It's natural for you to be confused. Just before she left, she told me about High Ridge. Right now, that sounds like just the place for me." "What is it?" "A kind of halfway house. She kept explaining that it was a house, not a shelter, for battered women, which is what I guess I now officially am." This time the wan chuckle sounded perilously close to a sob. "I can have Nat with me if I go, and that's a major part of the attraction." "Where is this place?" "In the country, out toward Newport, I think." "Yeah, I guess I knew that." Of course he did. Ham Davenport had told him during his Woman Care spiel. "They're involved in family counseling, spouse and child abuse cases. They run a shelter for abused women over by the Newport town line." All at once, Woman Care seemed to be everywhere in his life. Ed would undoubtedly have seen sinister implications in this. "That Gretchen Tilbury is one hard sugar bun," Helen was saying. "Just before she left, she told me it was all right for me to love Ed." "It has to be all right," she said, "because love doesn't come out of a faucet you can turn on and off whenever you want to. But that I had to remember my love couldn't fix him, that not even Ed's love for Natalie could fix him, and that no amount of love changed my responsibility to take care of my child. I've been lying in bed thinking about that. I think I liked lying in bed and being mad better. It was certainly easier." "Yes," he said, "I can see how it might be. Helen, why don't you just take your pill and let it all go for a while?" "I will, but first I wanted to say thanks." "You know, you don't have to do that." "I don't think I know any such thing," she said, and Ralph was glad to hear the flash of emotion in her voice. It meant the essential Helen Deepnow was still there. "I haven't quit being mad at you, Ralph, but I'm glad you didn't listen when I told you not to call the police. It's just that I was afraid, you know? Afraid. Helen, I..." His voice was thick, close to cracking. He cleared his throat and tried again. "I just didn't want to see you hurt any more than you already were. When I saw you coming across the parking lot with blood all over your face, I was just so afraid." "Don't talk about that part. Please, I'll cry if you do. And I can't stand to cry anymore." "Okay." He had 1,000 questions about Ed, but this was clearly not the time to ask them. "Can I come see you tomorrow?" There was a short hesitation, and then Helen said, "I don't think so. Not for a little while. I have a lot of thinking to do, a lot of things to sort out, and it's going to be hard. I'll be in touch, Ralph, okay?" "Of course, that's fine. What are you doing about the house?"
Candy's husband is going to go over and lock it up. I gave him my keys. Gretchen Tilbury said that Ed isn't supposed to go back for anything, not even his checkbook or a change of underwear. If there's stuff he needs, he gives the list and his house key to a policeman, and the policeman goes to get it. I suppose he'll go to Fresh Harbor. There's plenty of housing there for lab employees. These little cottages, they're actually sort of cute. The brief flash of fire he'd heard in her voice was long gone. Helen now sounded depressed, forlorn, and very, very tired. Helen, I'm delighted that you called, and relieved. I won't kid you about that. Now get some sleep. What about you, Ralph? She asked unexpectedly. Are you getting any sleep these days? The switch in focus startled him into an honesty he might not otherwise have managed. Some, but maybe not as much as I need. Probably not as much as I need. Well, take care of yourself. You were very brave today, like a knight in a story about King Arthur. But I think even Sir Lancelot had to fall out every now and then. He was touched by this, and also amused. A momentary picture, very vivid, arose in his mind. Ralph Roberts, dressed in armor and mounted on a snow-white steed, while Bill McGovern, his faithful squire, rode behind him on his pony, dressed in a leather jerkin and his snappy Panama hat. "Thank you, dear," he said. "I think that's the sweetest thing anyone said to me since Lyndon Johnson was president. Have the best night you can, okay?" "Okay. You too." She hung up. Ralph stood looking at the phone thoughtfully for a moment or two, then put it back in its cradle. Perhaps he would have a good night. After everything that had happened today, he certainly deserved one. For the time being, he thought he might go downstairs, sit on the porch, watch the sun go down, and let later take care of itself. McGovern was back, slouched in his favorite chair on the porch. He was looking at something up the street and didn't immediately turn when his upstairs neighbor stepped outside. Ralph followed his gaze and saw a blue step van parked at the curb half a block up Harris Avenue, on the Red Apple side of the street. Derry Medical Services was printed across the rear doors in large white letters. "Hi, Bill," Ralph said, and dropped into his own chair. The rocker where Lois Chass always sat when she came over stood between them. A little twilight breeze had sprung up, delightfully cool after the heat of the afternoon, and the empty rocker moved lazily back and forth at its whim. "Hi," McGovern said, glancing over at Ralph. He started to look away, then did a double take. "Man, you better start pinning up the bags under your eyes. You're going to be stepping on them pretty soon if you don't." Ralph thought this was supposed to come out sounding like one of the caustic little bon mots for which McGovern was famous along the street. But the look in his eyes was one of genuine concern. "It's been a bitch of a day," he said. He told McGovern about Helen's call, editing out the things he thought she might be uncomfortable with McGovern knowing. Bill had never been one of her favorite people. "Glad she's okay," McGovern said. "I'll tell you something, Ralph. You impressed me today, marching up the street that way like Gary Cooper in High Noon. Maybe it was insane, but it was also pretty cool." He paused. "To tell the truth, I was a little in awe of you." This was the second time in 15 minutes that someone had come close to calling Ralph a hero. It made him uncomfortable. "I was too mad at him to realize how dumb I was being until later. Where you been, Bill? I tried to call you a little while ago." "I took a walk out to the extension," McGovern said. "Trying to cool my engine off a little, I guess. I felt headachy and sick to my stomach ever since Johnny Lydecker and that other one took Ed away." Ralph nodded. "Me too." "Really?" McGovern looked surprised and a little skeptical. "Really?" Ralph said with a faint smile. "Anyway, Faye Chapin was out at the picnic area where those old lags usually hang out during the hot weather, and he coaxed me into a game of chess. What a piece of work that guy is, Ralph.
He thinks he's the reincarnation of Ruy Lopez. But he plays chess more like Soupy Sales. And he never shuts up. Faye's all right, though, Ralph said quietly. McGovern seemed not to have heard him. And that creepy Dorrance Marsteller was out there, he went on. If we're old, he's a fossil. He just stands there by the fence between the picnic area and the airport with a book of poetry in his hands, watching the planes take off and land. Does he really read those books he carries around, do you think? Or are they just props? Good question, Ralph said. But he was thinking about the word McGovern had used to describe Dorrance. Creepy. It wasn't one he would have used himself. But there could be no doubt that old Dor was one of life's originals. He wasn't senile. At least Ralph didn't think he was. It was more as if the few things he said were the product of a mind that was slightly skewed and perceptions that were slightly bent. He remembered that Dorrance had been there that day last summer when Ed ran into the guy in the pickup truck. At the time, he thought that Dorrance's arrival had added the final screwy touch to the festivities. And Dorrance had said something funny. Ralph tried to recall what it was and couldn't. McGovern was gazing back up the street, where a whistling young man in a gray coverall had just come out of the house in front of which the medical services step van was parked. This young man, looking all of 24, and as if he hadn't needed a single medical service in his entire life, was rolling a dolly with a long green tank strapped to it. "That's the empty," McGovern said. "You missed them taking in the full one." A second young man, also dressed in a coverall, stepped out through the front door of the small house, which combined yellow paint and deep pink trim in an unfortunate manner. He stood on the stoop for a moment, hand on the doorknob, apparently speaking to someone inside. Then he pulled the door shut and ran lithely down the walk. He was in time to help his colleague lift the dolly, with the tank still strapped to it, into the back of the van. "Oxygen?" Ralph asked. McGovern nodded. "For Mrs. Locker?" McGovern nodded again, watching as the medical services workers slammed the doors of the step van and then stood behind them, talking quietly in the fading light. "I went to grammar school and junior high with May Locker, way out in Codville, home of the brave and land of the cows. There were only 5 of us in our graduating class. Back in those days, she was known as a hot ticket, and fellows like me were known as a wee bit lavender. In that amusingly antique era, gay was how you described your Christmas tree after it was decorated." Ralph looked down at his hands, uncomfortable and tongue-tied. Of course he knew that McGovern was a homosexual, had known it for years, but he had never spoken of it out loud until this evening. He wished Bill could have saved it for another day, preferably one when Ralph himself wasn't feeling as if most of his brains had been replaced with goose down. "That was about 1,000 years ago," McGovern said. "Who'd have thought we'd both wash up on the shores of Harris Avenue?" "It's emphysema she has, isn't that right?" "I think that's what I heard." "Yep. One of those diseases that keeps on giving. Getting old is certainly no job for sissies, is it?" "No, it's not," Ralph said. And then his mind brought the truth of it home with sudden force. It was Carolyn he thought of, and the terror he had felt when he came squelching into the apartment in his soaked Converse sneakers and had seen her lying half in and half out of the kitchen, exactly where he had stood during most of his conversation with Helen, in fact. Facing Ed Deepno had been nothing compared to the terror he had felt at that moment when he had been sure Carolyn was dead. "I can remember when they just brought May oxygen once every 2 weeks or so," McGovern said. "Now they come every Tuesday and Thursday evening, like clockwork. I go over and see her when I can. Sometimes I read to her the most boring women's magazine bullshit you can imagine. And sometimes we just sit and talk. She says it feels as if her lungs are filling up with seaweed. It won't be long now. They'll come one day, and instead of loading an empty oxy tank into the back of that wagon, they'll load May in. They'll take her off to Derry Home, and that'll be the end." "Was it cigarettes?" Ralph asked. McGovern favored him with a look so alien to that lean, mild face that it took Ralph several moments to realize it was contempt. May Perrault never smoked a cigarette in her whole life. What she's paying off is 20 years in the dye house at a mill in Corina, and another 20 working the picker at a mill in Newport. It's cotton, wool, and nylon she's trying to breathe through, not seaweed. The two young men from Derry Medical Services got into their van and drove away. Maine's the northeastern anchor of Appalachia, Ralph. A lot of people don't realize that, but it's true. And May's dying of an Appalachian disease. The doctors call it textile lung. That's a shame. I guess she means a lot to you. McGovern laughed ruefully. Nah, I visit her because she happens to be the last visible piece of my misspent youth. Sometimes I read to her, and I always manage to get down one or two of her dry old oatmeal cookies. But that's about as far as it goes. My concern is safely selfish, I assure you. Safely selfish, Ralph thought? What a really odd phrase. What a really McGovern phrase. Never mind May, McGovern said. The question on the lips of Americans everywhere is what we're going to do about you, Ralph. The whiskey didn't work, did it? No, Ralph said. I'm afraid it didn't. To make a particularly apropos pun, did you give it a fair shot? Ralph nodded. Well, you have to do something about the bags under your eyes, or you'll never land the lovely Lois. McGovern studied Ralph's facial response to this and sighed. Not that funny, huh? Nope. It's been a long day. Sorry. It's okay. They sat in companionable silence for a while, watching the comings and goings on their part of Harris Avenue. Three little girls were playing hopscotch in the Red Apples parking lot across the street. Mrs. Perrine stood nearby, straight as a sentry, watching them. A boy with his Red Sox cap turned around backward went past, bopping to the beat of his Walkman headset. Two kids were tossing a frisbee back and forth in front of Lois's house. A dog barked. Somewhere a woman was yelling for Sam to get his sister and come inside. It was just the usual street life serenade, no more, no less. But to Ralph it all seemed strangely false. He supposed it was because he'd gotten so used to seeing Harris Avenue empty lately. He turned to McGovern and said, "You know what was just about the first thing I thought of when I saw you in the Red Apple parking lot this afternoon? In spite of everything else that was going on?" McGovern shook his head. "I wondered where the hell your hat was. The Panama. You looked very strange to me without it. Naked, almost. So come clean. Where did you stash the lid, son?" McGovern touched the top of his head, where the remaining strands of his baby-fine white hair were combed carefully left to right across his pink skull. "I don't know," he said. "I missed it this morning. I almost always remember to drop it on the table by the front door when I come in. But it's not there. I suppose I put it down somewhere else this time, and the exact locale has slipped my mind for the nonce. Give me another few years, and I'll be wandering around in my underwear because I can't remember where I left my pants. All part of the wonderful aging experience. Right, Ralph?" Ralph nodded and smiled, thinking to himself that of all the elderly people he knew, and he knew at least three dozen on a casual walk in the park, "Hi, how you doing?" basis, Bill McGovern bitched the most about getting on in years. He seemed to regard his vanished youth and recently departed middle age as a general would regard a couple of soldiers who desert on the eve of a big battle. He wasn't about to say such a thing, however. Everyone had their little eccentricities. Being theatrically morbid about growing old was simply one of McGovern's. "Did I say something funny?" McGovern asked. "Pardon?" "You were smiling, so I thought I must have said something funny." He sounded a bit touchy, especially for a man so fond of ribbing his upstairs neighbor about the pretty widow down the street. But Ralph reminded himself it had been a long day for McGovern, too. "I wasn't thinking about you at all," Ralph said. "I was thinking about how Carolyn used to say practically the same thing, that getting old was like getting a bad dessert at the end of a really fine meal." This was at least half a lie. Carolyn had made the metaphor, but she had used it to describe the brain tumor that was killing her, not her life as a senior citizen. She hadn't been all that senior anyway,
just 64 when she died. And until the last 6 or 8 weeks of her life, she'd claimed to feel only half of that on most days. Across the street, the three girls who had been playing hopscotch approached the curb, looked both ways for traffic, then joined hands and ran across the street, laughing. For just a moment, they looked to him as if they were surrounded by a gray glow, a nimbus that illuminated their cheeks and brows and laughing eyes like some strange, clarifying St. Elmo's fire. A little frightened, Ralph squeezed his eyes shut and then popped them open again. The gray envelope he'd imagined around the trio of girls was gone, which was a relief. But he had to get some sleep soon. He had to. Ralph? McGovern's voice seemed to be coming from the far end of the porch, although he hadn't moved. You all right?
Sure, Ralph said. Thinking about Ed and Helen, that's all.
Did you have any idea how screwy he was getting, Bill?
McGovern shook his head decisively. None whatsoever, he said. And although I saw bruises on Helen from time to time, I always believed her stories about them. I don't like to think of myself as a tremendously gullible person, but I may have to reassess my thinking on that score. What do you think will happen with them? Any predictions?
McGovern sighed and touched the top of his head with his fingertips, feeling for the missing Panama without realizing it.
You know me, Ralph. I'm a cynic from a long line of them. I think it's very rare for ordinary human conflicts to resolve themselves the way they do on TV. In reality, they just keep coming back, turning in diminishing circles until they finally disappear. Except disappearing isn't really what they do. They dry up like mud puddles in the sun.
McGovern paused and then added, and most of them leave the same scummy residue behind.
Jesus, Ralph said, that is cynical.
McGovern shrugged.
Most retired teachers are cynical, Ralph. We see them come in so young and so strong, so convinced that it's going to be different for them, and we see them make their messes and then paddle around in them, just as their parents and grandparents did. What I think is that Helen will go back to him, and Ed will do okay for a while, and then he'll beat her up again, and she'll leave again. It's like one of those sappy country western songs they have on the juke out at Nicky's lunch, and some people have to listen to that song a long, long time before they decide they don't want to hear it anymore. Helen's a bright young woman, though. I think one more verse is all she'll need.
One more verse might be all she'll ever get, Ralph said quietly.
We're not talking about some drunk husband coming home on Friday night and beating his wife up because he lost his paycheck in a poker game, and she dared to bitch about it.
I know, McGovern said, but you asked for my opinion and I gave it to you. I think Helen's going to need one more verse on the jukebox before she can bring herself to call it off. And even then they're apt to keep on bumping up against each other. It's still a pretty small town.
He paused, squinting down the street.
Oh, look, he said, hoisting his left brow. Our Lois, she walks in beauty like the night.
Ralph gave him an impatient look, which McGovern either did not see or pretended not to. He got up, once again touching the tips of his fingers to the place where the Panama wasn't, and then went down the steps to meet her on the walk.
Lois, McGovern cried, dropping on one knee before her and extending his hands theatrically.
Would that our lives might be united by the starry bonds of love. Wed your fate to mine, and let me whirl you away to climes various in the golden car of my affections.
Gee, are you talking about a honeymoon or a one-night stand? Lois asked, smiling uncertainly.
Ralph poked McGovern in the back. Get up, fool, he said, and took the small bag Lois was carrying. He looked inside and saw three cans of beer.
McGovern got to his feet.
Sorry, Lois, he said. It was a combination of summer twilight and your beauty. I plead temporary insanity, in other words.
Lois smiled at him, then turned to Ralph.
I just heard what happened, she said, and I hurried over as fast as I could. I was in Ludlow all afternoon, playing nickel-dime poker with the girls.
Ralph didn't have to look at McGovern to know that his left eyebrow,
The one that said, "Poker with the girls, how wonderfully, typically, perfectly our Lois," would be hoisted to its maximum altitude. "Is Helen all right?"
"Yes," Ralph said. "Well, maybe not exactly all right. They're keeping her in the hospital overnight. But she's not in any danger."
"And the baby?"
"Fine. Staying with a friend of Helen's." "Well, come on up on the porch, you two, and tell me all about it." She linked one arm through McGovern's, the other through Ralph's, and led them back up the walk. They mounted the porch steps that way, like two elderly musketeers, with a woman whose affections they had vied for in the days of their youth held safely between them. And as Lois sat down in her rocking chair, the street lights went on along Harris Avenue, glimmering in the dusk like a double rope of pearls. Ralph fell asleep that night, bare instants after his head hit the pillow, and came wide awake again at 3:30 a.m. on Friday morning. He knew immediately there was no question of going back to sleep. He might as well proceed directly to the wing chair in the living room. He lay there a moment longer anyway, looking up into the dark and trying to catch the tail of the dream he'd been having. He couldn't do it. He could only remember that Ed had been in it, and Helen, and Rosalie, the dog he sometimes saw limping up or down Harris Avenue before Pat the paperboy showed up. Dorrance was in it, too. Dorrance Marstella. Don't forget him. And as if a key had turned in a lock, Ralph suddenly remembered the strange thing Dorrance had said during the confrontation between Ed and the heavyset man last year. The thing Ralph hadn't been able to remember earlier this evening when McGovern brought the old man's name up. He'd been holding Ed back, trying to keep him pinned against the bent hood of his car long enough for reason to reassert itself. And Dorrance had said,
"I wouldn't,"
that Ralph ought to stop touching him.
"He said he couldn't see my hands anymore," Ralph muttered, swinging his feet out of the bed. That was it. He sat where he was for a little while, head down, hair frizzed up wildly in back, his fingers laced loosely together between his thighs. At last he stepped into his slippers and shuffled into the living room. It was time to start waiting for the sun to come up. Although cynics always sounded more plausible than the cockeyed optimists of the world, Ralph's experience had been that they were wrong at least as much of the time, if not more. And he was delighted to find that McGovern was wrong about Helen Deepnow. In her case, a single verse of the beaten-up, broken-hearted blues seemed to have been enough. On Wednesday of the following week, just as Ralph was deciding he'd better track down the woman Helen had spoken with in the hospital, Tilbury. Her name had been Gretchen Tilbury, and tried to make sure Helen was okay. He received a letter from her. The return address was simple, just Helen and Nat, High Ridge. But it was enough to relieve Ralph's mind considerably. He sat down in his chair on the porch, tore the end off the envelope, and shook out two sheets of lined paper crammed with Helen's back-slanted handwriting. "Dear Ralph," the letter began, "I suppose by now you must be thinking I decided to be mad at you after all. But I really didn't. It's just that we're supposed to stay out of contact with everyone, by phone and letter, for the first few days. Rules of the house. I like this place very much, and so does Nat." "Of course she does. There are at least six kids her age to crawl around with. As for me, I'm finding more women who know what I've been through than I ever would have believed. I mean, you see the TV shows. Oprah talks with women who love men who use them for punching bags. But when it happens to you, you can't help feeling that it's happening in a way it's never happened to anyone else, in a way that's brand new to the world. The relief of knowing that's not true is the best thing that's happened to me in a long, long time." She talked about the chores to which she had been assigned, working in the garden, helping to repaint an equipment shed, washing the storm windows with vinegar and water, and about Nat's adventures in learning to walk. The rest of the letter was about what had happened and what she intended to do about it. And it was here that Ralph for the first time really sensed the emotional turmoil Helen must be feeling, her worries about the future, and counterbalancing these things
a formidable determination to do what was right for Nat, and for her, too. Helen seemed to be just discovering that she also had a right to the right thing. Ralph was happy she had found out, but sad when he thought of all the dark times she must have trudged through in order to reach that simple insight. "I'm going to divorce him," she wrote. "Part of my mind, it sounds like my mother when it talks, just about howls when I put it that bluntly, but I'm tired of fooling myself about my situation. There's a lot of therapy out here, the kind of thing where people sit around in a circle and use up about 4 boxes of Kleenex in the course of an hour. But it all seems to come back to seeing things plain. In my case, the plain fact is that the man I married has been replaced by a dangerous paranoid. That he can sometimes be loving and sweet isn't the point, but a distraction. I need to remember that the man who used to bring me hand-picked flowers now sometimes sits on the porch and talks to someone who isn't there. A man he calls the little bald doctor. Isn't that a beaut? I think I have an idea of how all this started, Ralph. And when I see you, I'll tell you, if you really want to hear. I should be back at the house on Harris Avenue, for a while anyway, by mid-September, if only to look for a job. But no more about that now. The whole subject scares me to death. I had a note from Ed, just a paragraph, but a great relief just the same, saying that he was staying at one of the cottages at the Hawking Labs compound in Fresh Harbor, and that he would honor the non-contact clause in the bail agreement. He said he was sorry for everything, but I didn't get any real sense of it, if he was. It's not that I was expecting tear stains on the letter, or a package with his ear in it, but I don't know. It was as if he wasn't really apologizing at all, but just getting on the record. Does that make sense? He also included a $750 check, which seems to indicate he understands his responsibilities. That's good, but I think I'd have been happier to hear he was getting help with his mental problems. That should be his sentence, you know. 18 months at hard therapy. I said that in group, and several people laughed as if they thought I was joking. I wasn't. Sometimes I get these scary pictures in my head when I try to think of the future. I see us standing in line at Manor for a free meal, or me walking into the Third Street homeless shelter with Nat in my arms, wrapped in a blanket. When I think of that stuff, I start to shake. Sometimes I cry. I know it's stupid. I've got a graduate degree in library science, for God's sake, but I can't help it. And do you know what I hold on to when those bad pictures come? What you said after you took me behind the counter in the Red Apple and sat me down. You told me that I had a lot of friends in the neighborhood, and I was going to get through this. I know I have one friend, at least. One very true friend. The letter was signed, Love, Helen. Ralph wiped tears from the corners of his eyes. He cried at the drop of a hat just lately, it seemed. It probably came from being so goddamn tired. And read the P.S. she had crammed in at the bottom of the sheet and up the right-hand margin. I'd love to have you come and visit, but men are off limits out here for reasons I'm sure you will understand. They even want us to be quiet about the exact location. H. Ralph sat for a minute or two with Helen's letter in his lap, looking out over Harris Avenue. It was the tag end of August now, still summer, but the leaves of the poplars had begun to gleam silver when the wind stroked them, and there was the first touch of coolness in the air. The sign in the window of the Red Apple said, "School supplies of all types. Check here first." And somewhere out by the Newport town line, in some big old farmhouse where battered women went to try and start putting their lives back together, Helen Deepnow was washing storm windows, getting them ready for another long winter. He slid the letter carefully back into its envelope, trying to remember how long Ed and Helen had been married. 7 or 8 years, he thought. Carolyn would have known for sure. How much courage does it take to fire up your tractor and plow under a crop you spent 7 or 8 years growing, he asked himself. How much courage to go on and do that after you've spent all that time finding out how to prepare the soil and when to plant and how much to water and when to reap. How much to just say, I have to quit these peas. Peas are no good for me. I better try corn or beans. A lot, he said, wiping at the corners of his eyes again. A damn lot, that's what I think. Suddenly he wanted very badly to see Helen again, to repeat what she so well remembered hearing and what he could barely remember saying. You'll be okay. You'll get through this. You have a lot of friends in the neighborhood. Take it to the bank, Ralph said. Hearing from Helen seemed to have taken a great weight off his shoulders. He got up, put her letter in his back pocket, and started up Harris Avenue toward the picnic area on the extension. If he was lucky, he could find Faye Chapin or Don Veazey and play a little chess. His relief at hearing from Helen did nothing to alleviate Ralph's insomnia. The premature waking continued, and by Labor Day he was opening his eyes around 2:45 a.m. By the 10th of September, the day when Ed Deepnow was arrested again, this time along with 15 others, Ralph's average night's sleep had shrunk to roughly 3 hours, and he'd begun to feel quite a little bit like something on a slide under a microscope. Just a lonely protozoa, that's me, he thought, as he sat in the wingback chair, staring out at Harris Avenue, and wished he could laugh. His list of surefire, never-miss folk remedies continued to grow, and it had occurred to him more than once that he could write an amusing little book on the subject, if, that was, he ever got enough sleep to make organized thinking possible again. This late summer he was doing well to slide into matching socks each day, and his mind kept turning to his purgatorial efforts to find a cup of soup in the kitchen cabinet on the day Helen had been beaten. There'd been no return to that level since, because he had managed at least some sleep every night. But Ralph was terribly afraid he would arrive there again, and perhaps places beyond there, if things didn't improve. There were times, usually sitting in the wingback chair at 4:30 in the morning, when he swore he could actually feel his brains draining. The remedies ranged from the sublime to the ridiculous. The best example of the former was a full-color brochure advertising the wonders